Call the Tax Committee to order, and Representative Howe is here, and we want to start out with his. We had two committees scheduled today to do the jobs bill, and we lost one due to the floor debate. So we want to kind of get going as quick as we can. So Representative Howe, welcome to the committee.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. I know there's going to be layover, so we'll just make it real quick.
And I think Representative Tilbury wants to move your bill for you. Representative Tilbury moves House Bill 2656 for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Representative Howe.
Okay, I'm here to talk to you about this bill. The City of St. Paul would like some small changes made to one of its existing TIF district along University Avenue so that they will be able to use this increment for public infrastructure like cityscape, lights, trees, or stations. With me today is Todd Hurley, the city's treasurer, to explain the bill.
Welcome.
Good evening. Chair Lencheski, members of the committee, my name is Todd Hurley, and I'm the treasurer for the City of St. Paul. Last year, the city brought a bill before this committee that would have expanded the city's use of TIF, including extending some of the terms on multiple districts. The committee had many concerns with that bill. We listened to those concerns over in the city and greatly reduced the scope of what we are asking for this year. The bill before you pertains to the city's redevelopment TIF district at Snelling and University. The district was created in 1990 and certified by Ramsey County in 1992. At the time, the city had not been aware of the additional costs that would be associated with the Central Corridor Transit Project. The district's a 25-year district, scheduled to be decertified in 2016. This bill, if adopted, would do three things for assisting the city to use Snelling University TIF tax increments on eligible public expenditures in the Central Corridor Project area. First, it would provide relief from the five-year rule for the Snelling University TIF district. Second, it would allow the city to use this increment in the Central Corridor Project area. And third, it would also grant us relief from the 90% rule, which would allow the city to spend the increment on public infrastructure in the project area without the blight analysis required. If there's any questions, I can take them now.
Great. Thank you. Questions from committee members?
All right. Thank you.
I do want to say thank you to the City of St. Paul, who I know I've disappointed in the past as far as what you had hoped in this area, but this is a start, and I appreciate working with you on that. I want to ask Mr. Michael for the record here before I move on. It's just if I believe your bill before us, Representative Howe, is in its entirety in the jobs bill that we're going to hear later, but I just want to double check to figure out if we've got kind of the exact same thing in there or not. So, Mr. Michael?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, if you look at the amendment to 2695, it's on page 42, section 41. The entire language of the bill is in the amendment, plus there's an additional paragraph that, as with all of these TIF provisions, conditions that on construction or agreements being made by July 1st of 2011, so that's which I don't believe, based on conversations with St. Paul, that that's a problem.
Okay, so I think page 41, is that what you said, Mr. Michael?
42.
Page. Okay, so you've looked at all that and think and the goal here in the jobs bill is to try to get as many projects going as possible by July 1st of 11. So St. Paul's good with that? Is that right? Okay, further questions for anyone for the City of St. Paul or Representative Tao?
Nope.
If not, Representative Tao, closing thoughts, we're going to lay it over.
Thank you. This is democracy at its best.
Thank you. We'll lay this over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill, and it's in the jobs bill. So thank you. Appreciate you being here. We are waiting for Representative Mullery. Has anybody seen him? I'd like to get that one out of the way before we start the jobs bill. Well, if he's, do you have any idea where he is? Just go. I think in the interest of time, we're going to go to, well, I was going to ask Representative Gardner if he would chair the committee while I go through the jobs bill. Representative Gardner?
I'm taking this picture. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Madam Chair, your Representative Lucheski, would you like to move your bill?
If I may, yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 2695. And I would also, if I may, I'd like to move the H2695DE1A amendment. The authors delete all amendment.
Quite a wad of paper here, so hold on. Representative Lucheski moves 2695, and you have the DE1A amendment. So this is a total delete all then. Very good. Does everybody have the second big stack here? Let's see. Very good. Do you want to go ahead with your, or excuse me, members, let's adopt the DE1 amendment. I'm a little rusty. To put the bill in the shape the author would like, all those in favor of the DE1A amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Are those opposed? Motion passes. To your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, just preliminarily, I'd just like to say the goal here is to put as many people as possible to work as quickly as possible as we can in a time of limited resources. And so we've passed and the governor has signed portions of the bonding bill, and that was a big jobs bill. And now this is another attempt to use things in the area of the tax committee to put some folks to work, again, recognizing the scarcity of the situation that we have. And so if I can just walk through the provisions with members, there is a House summary, and working off, I guess I'm working off the actual delete all amendment. It's the 44-page document. So members, section 1 and 2, that's pages 1 through 11 of the bill, is the angel investor tax credit. And folks have known how I felt about that. There has been a pretty broad consensus bipartisanly and with the governor's office in both the House and Senate that most members like this kind of a proposal, and there's been a lot of work on this proposal. I want to thank Representatives Dabney and Mahoney, who've really worked hard to get this bill, along with me and senators and others, in the form it's in the bill now. And we think we have broad agreement on the angel investor tax credit. And rather, pardon me.
Representative Lucheski, before you get too into it, I see Representative Mulley's arrived. I don't know if you want to take care of that bill or the big. Okay, let's run through it.
Okay, so rather than going through the minutia of the angel investor tax credit, if people have members or questions about it, Representative Dabney is here, and of course our nonpartisan fiscal staff can get really into the details, because I know some of the members are really interested in that. But I will just say broadly, so that members know what the angel tax credit is. It's a 25% credit for investments made in qualifying businesses up to $125,000 per investor and $1 million per business. And it sunsets in 2014. As we know, we've been trying to get our heads around tax expenditures and review them. This has a sunset on it, as has been recommended by most policy bodies going forward with tax expenditures. To qualify for this money, you'd have to have your headquarters in Minnesota, have 51% of your employees and 51% of your payroll in Minnesota, and have less than $2 million in gross sales. There are a number of other provisions that are detailed about the angel investor tax credit. But I would tell you of interest to the committee, I think, is that we hope to be groundbreaking in accountability as we go down the road of the angel investor tax credit. And this bill carries a program evaluation, an annual report, public data from Deed, and I think most importantly, a clawback. And there's been broad agreement with Deed, Department of Revenue, the Senate, and the House to try to get this into a workable credit. So that, again, is pages 1 through 11 of the amendment. Section 3 and 4, which start at the bottom of page 11, is the special assessment for energy efficiency. Representative Kalin has worked very hard on this. This allows property owners voluntarily to request special assessment from a city to finance capital improvements for energy efficiency. And so folks who have more detailed questions about that, we can get into that. Sections 5 and 6 of the author's amendment, page 14 of the bill is the historic tax credit slash grant. And I want to particularly give kudos to the historic credit community. These folks have been willing to take on what most people have shied away from, which is to take a shot at a grant. So we've got a grant and a credit here, kind of a hybrid with incentives built in to hopefully have some folks try out the grant, thereby receiving actually more assistance than they would under a credit. So the historic rehabilitation credit, again, it's either a grant or a refundable credit. The federal tax credit right now for historic structures is 20, and then we would add 20 at the state level for a combined credit of 40, or an investor could choose a grant equal to 90% of the credit. The Minnesota Historical Society is required to report back to us, and we're trying to build in, again, accountability, and we're sunsetting it in 2014, again, to build in accountability so future legislatures can decide if these two credits work and if they want to continue to pay for them. So that's those parts of the bill. Section 7, which is page 18 of the author's amendment, that's the REIT provision.
Representative Lincheski, did you want to just read through it before you take questions, or do you want to?
Yeah, I was just trying to get through the whole thing and then take questions on all of it, just so there people could see the scope of all the things going on in the bill that are attempting to create jobs. It's very broad and across multiple industries and all around the state and multiple methods of trying to get our heads around job creation.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Page 18 is the REIT provision. This is the, the provision that started all this, and Commissioner Innes and the working with Senator Bach and I, we had hoped REIT was going to raise $10 million a year and thereby pay for both the historic and the Angel credit. When it was scored by revenue, it raises a little less than $1 million a year, so that is in there. And, of course, we have to find more revenue to pass this bill, but the REIT provision, this is federal tax treatment of corporations that receive dividends from REITs, and it's a part of the conformity that we did not pass. So it's a small part that we have not yet captured, and we would want to go on and capture that provision. Then in section 5 of the author's amendment, page 20, as part of a suggestion by the historic tax credit advocates, they brought forward, I thought, a really good idea, which was to allow the credit for the insurance premiums tax as part of the historic credit. Other places have done this. This is a really stable funding source, and the insurance companies are often sort of looking for ways to reduce their tax liability, and the historic credit would afford them that opportunity. So we've added that. That's page 20. Section 9 and 10, yeah, and the bottom of page 20 through page 23, this is more of the special assessment language that I talked about with Representative Kalin, working on for energy efficiency to build more projects that way. These are voluntary special assessments where groups come together and ask to be taxed. Section 11, which is page 23 of the author's amendment, this is state revenue bonding for local transportation through the Public Finance Authority. This is the kind of provision you'd normally see carried in the House tax bill in the public finance portion of the House tax omnibus bill. This would allow for Build America bonds or other tax-exempt bonds. This would help projects like the Mall of America and projects across the state if people choose to afford themselves of this new language. Section 12 and 13, which is page 24 through 26 of the bill, this is the green building bonds. These are revenue bonds for green buildings. This is sort of follows the Obama stimulus concept, and again, these are revenue bonds for green building. Sections 14, 15, 16, and 17 is the compact TIF district for transit-oriented developments. This creates a new TIF district that would encourage compact transit-friendly development. You have to have 70% of the land has to be in buildings that are already up. And then to qualify, you have to do 3 times the development in square footage of the buildings that are already up. You cannot use it for roads or for parking. These are for transit. This is to have further transit-oriented TIF districts. Section 18 of the author's amendment, which is pages 28 through 30, this expands TIF uses for economic development. This is a really critical piece for the construction trades and for trying to get the vertical construction industry going. What this does is it allows for some expanded TIF uses. It provides for temporary authority for new TIF districts for any development project, as long as the project begins by July of 2011. Again, we're focusing on getting things going now. We're not trying to get things going in 5 years. The concept is we're trying to put people to work right now, and the municipality needs to make a finding that the new TIF district would create new jobs. We have also allowed that you could use it for anything, including office, retail, and housing, which we have not allowed retail probably since the 80s. So this would be to try to get everybody out there and get their buildings up and get people to work. Section 19 of the author's amendment, this is temporary authority to stimulate TIF. This actually came from Brooklyn Park, had this idea. We put it in a bill last year, and it would say that if you have excess surplus increment, you could use that money for any purpose. Now, it's a patchwork of cities. Some cities have this excess surplus increment, and some don't. But for those who do have it, they would be able to use it in this way. And this would actually work sort of like a loan guarantee program. It would be used to help finance private development that otherwise would not have enough equity to receive bank financing or to fund more traditional project costs, such as public infrastructure. So this really came out of a lot of testimony we heard in the jobs task force about, you know, getting credit and what can you do to do that bridge financing, and this is one tool for folks to do that. Again, it would be limited for 2 years, trying to get things going quickly. Section 20 through 30 of the author's amendment, pages 31 through 36, represent Paymar's CARZ Ford Motor Plant investment proposal that we heard. Representative Paymar had a hearing in front of the committee. They're here tonight for more questions. The governor has proposed this, of course, in his tax proposal and mentioned it in the state as well. Section 31, which is pages 36, on page 36 of the bill, this is a Bloomington liquor and lodging change for the uses at Mall of America, Airport South, and Commuter Bridge in the area. This is, again, to try to help more flexibility and more financing for Mall of America and its surrounding lands. Section 32 and 33, which is page 37, 38 of the bill, or of the amendment, is Representative Mullery's housing replacement district, which is also on the calendar tonight. He has another part that we didn't include in the bill, but basically the housing replacement districts provides more flexibility to the three cities that have them, Crystal, Fridley, and Columbia, and authorizes two new cities, Brooklyn Park and St. Paul, to have them. It would also allow cities to use TIF to rehab houses that have been blighted by foreclosure. So we're, again, trying to get more construction out there, more development. Section 34 through 38, which is page 36 through 41, are a series of Mall of America provisions. There's the labor peace language in the bill. There is language to provide greater flexibility for development on both phases 1 and 2 of the Mall of America while still protecting property taxpayers from additional tax burdens. The language allows for proceeds from local taxes that the 2008 tax bill authorized. And members will recall who followed the Mall of America in the 2008 bill. There were 5 new taxes that were put into place for the Mall of America if the city of Bloomington and the mall chose to use them, none of which are statewide, all of which are contained within the city of Bloomington's borders. It's Bloomington hotel taxes, Bloomington restaurant taxes, the mall itself, a series of taxes in the building itself. So those 5 taxes, the sales tax at the mall, the amusement tax at the mall, the entertainment tax at the mall, all the revenue streams afforded in the 2008 bill came from the boundaries within the city of Bloomington. This allows flexibility for those 2008 taxes that were passed in 08, but now allows them to be used on either phase or one or two, because they were passed as just for phase 2. Let's see, and I should say for the record, the proposal does not involve the fiscal disparities pool and will not impact LGA distribution. Additionally, there is a sales tax change for the mall. The language was passed that the sales tax had, I believe, in the original language, it had to be at least a half cent and up to a cent. The mall has come forward and said, could we have a smaller increment than that? If we don't need a whole half a cent, we'd like to levy less than that. And so this language gives them, with the city of Bloomington's approval, the ability to have a smaller portion of the sales tax from their facility. And additionally, we've checked and it will not interfere with the streamlined sales tax. So it's okay to do that. See, there's another piece. flexibility in using the state revenue bonds. Again, this was approved in the 2008 legislation, but we would again want them to be either used in phase one or phase two. And a lot of this is driven by that the hotel that's being contemplated at the mall, and they're here and the city's here and they can get into more detail, is actually on phase one lands. And so being allowing more flexibility allows the project to go quicker and gives them some of the flexibility they're looking for. Section 39, can't read my own handwriting here. Oh, housing replacement districts for St. Paul. Page 41, which is, I'm not sure the section, this is the St. Paul Central Corridor TIF that Representative Howe just walked us through. That's in the bill. Page 41 is the Oakdale TIF. This is Representative Slawick's community, and members will recall that when we had that day here where we asked developers to just come forward and tell us if they had any projects that they were really close on, and if they could get some flexibility, they can make it go. Oakdale was one of those cities that came forward and told us about this one. Page 42, similarly, we heard from North Mankato. This is Representative Morrow's bill last year, and they're looking for some flexibility here in their TIF. And then I think the very last provision, Section 43, is the Mall of America repealer language. And what this is this would allow the City of Bloomington and the Mall of America to renegotiate the terms of their local investment formula. Now, this is not allowing them the ability to renegotiate how much money they will get from any of you or the state. This is between each other. There's no state resources involved, but it would afford the City of Bloomington and the Mall the ability to renegotiate the language that was set forth in 1986. Currently in law, if they both want to renegotiate the deal, both of them, they cannot. We have in statute, if the mall and the city say, hey, we'd like to cut a new deal together that doesn't impact anyone but us, we either want to give the developer more or less or help the city more or less, they cannot open that up. And this would allow them, they would both have veto authority over each other, of course, because they'd have to mutually agree to do so. But this would repeal that language that restricted them from ever reopening their contract for the development. So with that, Mr. Chair, that's the whole jobs bill for now.
Very good. Do we want to take questions from the committee quick and then take public testimony? Is that your desire, Representative Lucheski?
Whatever you'd like, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Well, that's your baby here. So I had Representative Demmer and then Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if I can remember my question. It was a very simple question. I think I
it
heard
was
you
comment
mention
about a great bill. I think.
I'm catching up.
Okay. And members, we're on the DE1A amendment. For those of you who came in
on the DE1 amendment, Madam Chair, I think I don't remember the provision. It was toward the beginning. I think you said a refundable credit. Are most of the credits in here refundable? And by refundable, that means whether or not they have tax liability, they get the money back again.
That's right.
Is there a lot of distinction between refundable and non-refundable? Is it pretty much refundable what's through here?
There's only two credits in here, and the historic is refundable, and the angel is not.
That's the one I was right.
Although that's open. Oh, we changed the angel. Okay. Representative Dabney might want to jump in on this. We had a long debate between transferability and refundability and the pluses and minuses for different folks on it. And there's been a lot of people kind of involved in the discussion, so maybe we did finally end up at refundable. But Representative Dabney?
You know, Madam Chair, I'm looking to be confident because it's a long debate and we went back and forth quite a bit. So let me look for the language. There was some significant conversation that a refundable credit on the angel would incent more angel investors to do more in the state, and that was actually of more value and kept more of the value in Minnesota than the transferability did. But let me review and see what I can find.
Actually, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Michael, do you want to help us here?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if you look on page 18, subdivision 4, which this is the actual provision of the angel investment credit that's in the tax chapter, not in the deed chapter, and subdivision 4 there makes it clear that it is refundable.
Any follow-up questions to that?
Mr. Chair, thank you. I think, is the historic credit also refundable then? I think that's what actually spurred my question. I didn't catch this one yet. I wasn't speed reading that well. Okay, thank you.
Representative Solberg.
One or the other?
Representative Lischinski.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, yes, there's an incentive financially to choose the grant, but folks may choose the credit. The credit is refundable. And both of these programs sunset in 5 years so that legislators can take a look at them.
So, Representative Broad, did you have your hand up?
I do. I just wanted to get on the list.
I think you're...
The list. Thank you. Representative Lischinski, thank you very much for all your work. I know you've worked hard. I'm just curious, related to understanding the parameters around your bill. In your discussions with the governor's office, are there any significant clinkers in the bill and related to their concerns coming from the governor's office, or is it more just details that need to get worked out and some funding sources? I'm just kind of wanting to get your thoughts related to that.
Representative Lischinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Broad. I hope they're here, and I hope they will say if they have any concerns on any of the language. I should very clearly express that my thanks to the governor's staff for all the work Deed and the Department of Revenue who have worked on with very many authors and lots of small, detailed working groups. If there is some big chunk, I'm not aware of it, but I think you have said, you know, the key is how do you pay for it? And so it's the revenue piece is really what we're down to here. And then if there are tweaks and changes, you know, we do need to hear about them from people. And we put the language out online on Friday, hoping that all the groups who are tracking these issues would let us know if they're having issues with it. The goal here, I should say, for process is there will not be a tax conference committee for this bill. This bill needs to be pre-agreed to with the Senate and the governor's office, and it's going to be sent over and there's concurrence. So we have to get that last revenue piece right before we go to Ways and Means with the bill. But the goal would be to pass it this week still and get it signed next week. So we really do need to hear from people who are having concerns. But we are not attempting to have a tax conference committee on this bill. We want full agreement with all parties so that we get it done and it actually is signed.
Just a follow-up,
and thank you again, Representative Lischinski, for being up front, and you're always gracious with us with the information that you have. I just hope that the department stops scoring REIT so that we can stop going in the wrong direction related to the dollars that might be available for it. But thank you. I look forward to working with you further on the language in the bill. There's a couple things that I think might need some tweaking that we can work on down the road.
Thank you. And I would like to hear any of that when people have time, either now or offline. Just let me know, because we want to get it right so that we're not later after it's law. We missed it.
Very good. And I beg your pardon, Representative Marquardt, I missed you before.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And I'm just appreciative, Representative Lischinski. There are several spots in this bill where it actually talks about jobs and accountability for jobs. On a historic credit, page 16, line 17 and 18, it says that the office, which is the Historic Preservation Office, when looking at these projects, has to consider the number of construction jobs expected to be created. In the next line, the number of jobs expected to be created when the project is completed. So I think those are good items. And then I notice on all of the TIF stuff, none of the extensions occur unless there's basically a developer's agreement knowing that a project's going to move forward. So I appreciate the accountability in those spots.
Thank you.
Representative Dimmer.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, going through, I noticed a labor peace agreement requirement for the City of Bloomington, any work being done on the Mall of America. Is that something that was there when it was originally built also? Is that a new provision, or is that a continuation of what was happening before? I wasn't here when that was done, so I don't know when they've been required or when they haven't.
And I wasn't here either. They're here, and they can talk about it. But I was in college, but, you know, Mr. Michael actually, I think, can tell us, because I think he had something to do with it, if labor peace, I believe, was in the original 86 language. I'm not positive. Maybe Mr. Michael would know.
Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chair, I don't recall. Yeah, I don't believe that it was. I think, my guess, you know, this is a feature that's tied to the hotel, and of course the original development did not have a hotel connected with it, so one would not have expected that it would have been an issue, but it was not. I don't, could be wrong, but I don't believe the legislature ever dictated anything on that in the 86 legislation, but the folks from the Mall of America are here, and I'm sure they can correct me if I'm wrong about that.
Representative Lencheski.
Mr. Chair, I think the Mall of America's representatives are here, and they can answer that if you'd like to do that now or later. I wouldn't want to speak for them.
And Representative Devney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lencheski, I reviewed the language related to the historic tax credit, and I'm a little confused by a couple of pieces. I'm surprised that it appears that the entity with the authority to grant the credits is not revenue, but it's the Historical Society. Am I reading that correctly?
If I may, Mr. Chair, can I ask Ms. Manzi to walk through that, the mechanics of that for members?
Sure. Ms. Manzi.
Madam Chair, Representative Dabney, could you point out to me what page and line you're looking at?
Representative Dabney.
Well, it came up in part on page 15, lines 10 and 11, which actually all touches on the grant alternative, but that's where one of the places where I picked up the reference to the society, which I believe, which refers to the Historical Society, I assume. Yeah, 15.1, it does. And I'm just surprised that it's the Historical Society, not revenue, not deed, not somebody like that. And I'm just wondering if I can get an explanation as to why the Historical Society, and maybe perhaps how other states with historic preservation tax credits handle the authority issue.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dabney, the Historical Society, there is in existence a federal credit for historic rehabilitation projects. And the Historical Society, and their representatives are here, and they can expand on this or correct me if I'm wrong, but the Historical Society, the Historic Preservation Office, already acts as the agent for the federal government in approving projects to receive the federal credit. Projects are approved before they begin rehabilitation, and then when they finish rehabilitation and place the building or project in service, that's when they receive the federal credit. The state credit would attempt to piggyback on the federal credit. It's a little complicated because under the budget constraints, we were directed to put a cap on the credit allocations in this language, so we can't simply have it be open and match whatever federal credits are allowed. Instead, the way it would work is that the developers with projects would come into the Historic Preservation Office, they call it the SHPO, the State Historic Preservation Office, before commencing, just as they do now for the federal credit. They would also submit an application for the state credit. That application includes an estimate of what their costs are going to be and what credit they expect to receive when the project is completed. At that time, the SHPO would take in all these applications and evaluate them using the criteria that Representative Marport highlighted, including the number of jobs that would be created. They would score them and decide which ones scored most highly on those criteria, and those ones that they approved would then receive what the language calls an allocation certificate that would reserve for them a maximum amount of state credit, which they would receive when they completed the project and placed it in service. When they do complete it, which may be up to 5 years after they get their allocation certificate, then they have to report back in to the SHPO, just like they do for the federal credit, and at that time they would get an actual credit certificate, which they would submit to the Department of Revenue in order to claim the credit amount. In drafting this, we thought it made more sense to have the Historic Preservation Office and the Historical Society be sort of the administrative unit because they're familiar with these projects, and it's not something that I think the Department of Revenue was anxious to take on learning about historic rehabilitation projects. So that's why the credit is first allocated and then the final certificates are issued after the project is completed by the Historical Society.
Mr. Chair, follow up.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you. To either Representative Lencheski or Ms. Manzi, going back to 15.10 and 11, this is the grant as alternative. I didn't notice any criteria in the bill, it gives the society authority to pay a grant instead of a credit, but I didn't see any rationale for why, any guidance to them as to why in case A, do a credit, and in case B, do a grant. And I'm wondering if I missed that in the bill, if that should be, if that's someplace else, if there's some other provisions that would govern when they would issue a grant and when they would issue a credit.
Ms. Manzi.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dabney, that would be up to the developer of the project and would depend largely on, I think, how the development deal was structured. Our understanding is that a lot of these deals are fairly complex and involve multiple investors and partners and so on. The grant would likely be more attractive if there were a nonprofit entity involved in it somehow that could then receive the grant. If you look on page 15, lines 17 through 19 of the bill, you'll see that the application for the state credit has to specify if they want to get the credit or if they want to get the grant or if they are applying for a partial credit and a partial grant. So we tried to give them flexibility to choose the option that worked best for the particular project.
Mr. Chair, one last question.
Certainly, Representative Abney.
Thank you. I'll turn around for this one. Looking, Representative Lincheski, at some of the TIF provisions, such as the Compact Development District and some of the expansive language allowing the use of TIF in areas that we haven't for many years in life, trying to wrap my brain around it, if I'm a developer or if I'm a municipality where a development is occurring, do I have to pick one, or can I pick multiple, can I layer in multiple of these TIF provisions over on the same project to provide a subsidy over here and a new construction of something at public expense over there and that sort of thing? Is that a fair question?
Representative Lincheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Dabney. I think, you know, many of the TIF districts in the state right now are mixed use, so people have office and housing and retail all in one. So I think, you know, in general, you know, you have to certify a district. You have to pick what you're going to do. So I don't think the layering effect would work. The compact TIF development transit might possibly work with an economic development TIF district. I guess I defer to Mr. Michael. I'm trying to think through logistically how that might work, but a city council has to certify a district per se, and they can only designate the district as one type of TIF, I believe. I don't think they can do two, so I don't know if Mr. Michael wants to
There's enough moving parts here. I'm trying to understand how they might move together.
And maybe before Mr. Michael answers, if I may, you know, the goal here is, I mean, this is really a stretch for me. I think folks know this about me. This is not something I am too happy about. On the other hand, you know, the testimony in the Jobs Task Force, loud and clear, is, sir, we need help. We need help. We need to get these buildings built. We need to get things going. And this is an attempt to say, okay, so we're going to break down the rules here that I think are good rules. You know, they're good rules. They're there for a reason. City councils like TIF districts because they get to have a discounted development, basically getting the county to subsidize the development in the city because they get to use the whole county tax base to do so. And it's all not transparent, and it's off the property tax levy. So there's a lot of reasons, as policymakers, all of us wouldn't want to do these things. On the other hand, legislators like TIF districts for a myriad of reasons as well. And so this is an attempt to say, geez, we're not going to break all the rules forever. We're going to say, if you've got something ready by July 1, 2011, that you are going to have substantial construction, you're breaking ground, we're going to let you kind of come in and do that. This isn't a permanent thing. It's not for 12 and 13 and 14 and 15. It's to get through the recession and to sort of buy the argument that people have said, you know, we're trapped, we're closed, we've got this developer, but the economy fell out, we can't get that last bit of financing, things are tough. So it is sort of knocking down these rules through 2011. I think that's the key here in all the stuff that's going on in these TIF districts, whether they're the compact one or letting retail or any other thing, is to say, okay, you got, you know, till July 1, 2011 to prove it. And I think a lot of the assertions people have made about, you know, if we could just get these flexibility, they'll be right, and they'll be able to get things done, and there will be more jobs because of it. In other cases, they'll be wrong. I think they'll find out it's just not going to be quite enough, but we can't really know that. And that day we asked the developers to come in and talk to us, you know, there was a lot of people here. And I think as legislators, we're just trying to find a middle ground here to give developers and cities more tools, but with a cautious eye to how flexible are we really going to get. But I think Mr. Michael can really answer the mechanics of can these districts layer on one another, if Mr. Chair would permit that.
Mr. Michael, are you able to chip in?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dabney, I think it's always conceptually useful to think about these TIF provisions as two types of provisions. One is provisions that give you more authority to collect increment, which means where can you draw and create a new TIF district so you can capture increment. And I think what the chair is saying, which is absolutely right, that, you know, basically if you have two different sets of rules that say, well, you can use these rules to create a new district or those rules to create a new district, you still can only create one district and capture the property taxes only once. And so you can't, for example, sort of combine the new economic development district with the new compact development district because there's only one set of property taxes that will be paid by that development. So from that perspective, there's no sort of doubling up. There is, but the other, so conceptually, you've got two things. One is the ability to collect increment, and second, there are a set of rules that say what can you spend increment on. And in general, most of the bill, the economic development, TIF districts, the compact, housing replacement, most of those go to where you can collect increment. But this other provision that the chair described before, this expanded authority for 2 years to use surplus increment from existing districts for those cities that are fortunate enough to have more increment than they need to pay the bonds and the other costs that they can incur, this bill gives them flexibility to use that money if that's necessary to stimulate new development in some other place in the city. And so that's where you could get this doubling up phenomenon. So you could, a city could say, gee, we really want this new, you know, X development to happen on this site, so we'll use the new economic development authority to do that, and we have surplus increment in our other district, and we will, because the developer really needs more assistance than just the tax increment from that district, we'll take that increment from that other district, which normally we could not do because of pooling restrictions or the five-year rule, and we'll export it to that other district. So that's an instance where there could, that's the only real instance where there could be this doubling up phenomenon, and that's a conscious thing to allow them to sort of maximize whatever the incentives they need to get this new construction to happen so that, you know, construction workers can go back to work, essentially.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
I had Representatives Broad, Solberg, Rukavina, and Mullery. Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Madam Chairman, I have just a couple extra questions. One thing that the building trades, I remember, asked for was kind of an extension for building permits. You know, we're trying to kind of clear out some hurdles. And I don't know that it's necessarily appropriate in a tax bill, but do you know whether that is part of, you know, something that might be brought in as part of your proposal or if that's being carried somewhere else? That seems to me like an easy assistance that we could do that wouldn't cost any money and would clear away some barriers.
Representative Lynchetsky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Broad. And I very intentionally did not put that in because, as you've said, it's not a tax item. I do think that it's, I listened to one of the Senate Finance Committees as they were walking through some of their jobs bills that are going through, and they talked about that a little bit, and it really hit me, you know, that if those things are going to move, Representative Pawlowski really needs to hear them and the people who serve on that committee, because those are really local government issues. And I think there was one where it sort of said, hey, the economy was bad, so all permits just get a year extension, I think. And I really wanted to keep this to tax items and tax items alone. I know Representative Rukavina also has jobs proposals, and then the bonding bill has been one. And his committee with Deed and Workforce Development is going to do things, but I felt it was really out of the purview of this committee to be dealing in issues that were not tax-related.
Sure. And, Mr. Chairman, just a couple more. And thank you, Representative Lynchetsky, for listening to the Senate. I did not do that. So second question is related to that compact TIF. I'm curious whether vacancy rates are a concern, and maybe this is something that somebody in the audience might address. You know, if we're going to be moving some TIFs and trying to create some vertical construction, my understanding is that in that the area of commercial real estate, that there's some pretty significant vacancy rates out there. And I'm just wondering if that might be a common sense parameter to put it in place related to the ability to use this tool. If you have a community that has significant vacancy, maybe it doesn't make sense to create a whole new set of construction if we can't fill what we have. And I just put that out there for your consideration. And then I'll just leap to the last question that I have is related to, I just don't understand the Section 8 on page 20, in the historic structure rehabilitation credit. I don't understand that premium tax piece, and I'm wondering if maybe either you or Mr. Michael might be able to help me just understand the link between that offset. They're two very separate questions.
Representative Lencheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Broad. I'm open to tightening that vacancy issue you just raised. I think there's a lot of merit to that, and we should have a conversation about that. It's one I hadn't thought of. This had originally come through the Metzen bill, and in reading, when I was trying to put this together, I read the Metzen bill from last year and tried to take all the pieces I could possibly support. And I have questions about how much this will work, but I would certainly be open to that vacancy piece. I would defer to Mr. Michael on the mechanics as far as the credit goes.
Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chair, Representative Broad, the insurance premiums tax essentially allows the historic credit. Well, let me back up. Almost all of the proposals for the historic credit have allowed credits against the individual income and the corporate franchise tax. What this does is that it just expands and adds another tax, the insurance premiums tax. The advantage of doing that, and this was suggested by some of the folks that are involved with the federal credit and credits in other states. Some other states do this, such as Missouri. The big advantage of it is that the insurance premium tax is essentially like a sales tax, and so it's a very predictable tax that the insurance companies know that they will always have liability under it. But more importantly, many of these insurance companies, because of the federal tax rules, actually do not have federal corporate tax liability. And so when you allow them the advantage of taking this credit against state tax, that normally triggers a federal tax liability, because when your state tax goes down, that's a business expense deduction for a business. Your federal tax goes up. So it's sort of an alchemy almost. If you can find a taxpayer that's got a state tax liability but does not have a federal tax liability, that credit is going to be much more valuable to them because they're not subject to that federal offset. And so it's almost as good as, a grant to a nonprofit in a way. And so this is a way where they can actually maximize the benefit of the credit if they can get those kinds of taxpayers to, make these investments.
Representative Solberg.
Very quickly, Mr. Chair, I noticed on page 16 of the jobs, counting of the jobs, one of the criteria for the historical thing is the number of jobs expected to be created when the project is completed. And I have also a handout here that deals with the Crookston historical building, and it's going into housing. So my question is, with that in there, would that kind of preclude housing, which obviously wouldn't have a lot of jobs after construction, from being down on the list of the available resources? Because I think housing would probably be somewhat of a good use of the historical credit.
Ms. Vancy, can you take that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Solberg, to back up a little bit and explain why this list of criteria is in the bill, it's here because the amount allowed for the credit is subject to a cap because of the budget constraints. So when we started out drafting this, we started out having the credit allocation administered by the Historical Society on a first-come, first-served basis. And in conversations with them and with some of the people who work on the federal credits, they suggested that they would prefer a structure more similar to a scoring system that's in place in the state of Ohio. And that's what this is modeled on. So the intent is their concern was that in other states with a first come first serve basis cap, they would actually have people camping out in front of the office on the day the applications were due. and it would not necessarily be the best projects that would be allocated the credit, simply the ones that came in first. So they wanted to have some discretion in how to evaluate the applications. If you look through the language, it doesn't really say anything about what weight they have to give to the different criteria. We wanted to put some criteria in so that it wouldn't be totally at the discretion of the Historical Preservation Society. That's sort of the tension here, is that the legislature doesn't necessarily fully want to relinquish control, but they recognize that the Historical Society has the expertise to evaluate these applications, and that first come, first serve is not necessarily going to be the best use of the state's money. So in the case of the Crookston project, it may lose points because of resulting in housing, but it may score highly on the other criteria, and it really would depend on what all the projects were that came in during that application period.
Okay, well, thank you. That's acceptable.
Representative Rukavina.
Thank you. Representative Lucheski, first of all, you mentioned, and in the portion dealing with the green buildings, that they're revenue bonds. Do you have to go to the capital bonding committee with this bill?
Representative Lucheski.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rukavina, no, this would normally be carried in the public finance part of the tax bill. These are revenue bonds for local units of government.
Well, Representative Mr. Chair, I ask that question because I have a bill in the higher ed and workforce development that dealt with revenue bonds for certain financing manufacturing, and the chair of the capital bonding committee asked that my bill be referred. So is there a special treatment if you're from the range, or if you're a guy, or what's the deal here?
Representative Lucheski.
Mr. Chair, and Representative Rukavina, I don't think so. I think my guess is, and I don't know what your bill was, but it might have been state bonding. And I will ask Mr. Michael if he's familiar with your bill. I mean, this is for local the tax committee is in charge of debt for political subdivisions of the state, whether it's cities or counties or whatever.
Well, I'm just checking here.
And I want to support you if you somehow got a bad deal there, so I just don't know.
And Representative Mr. Chair and Representative Lucheski, the angel investment credit portion of this bill, which, you know, I don't have a problem with. I mean, it's not that costly in a time of dire, you know, financial stress to the state of Minnesota, but it isn't that big. But I don't see anywhere in the bill where the actual jobs have to be, and maybe I'm missing it. There's criteria what the business has to be. It has to be headquartered here. It has to have at least 51% of its employees in payroll here, and then there's the other criteria. Where does it say that the jobs created have to be in Minnesota?
Representative Lucheski.
Representative Gardner, Mr. Chair, and Representative Rukavina, 51% of the jobs and 51% of the payroll has to be in Minnesota. Representative Dabney maybe wants to jump here. He's actually carrying the bill, but I do think this is the angel credit is the one that it's, you know, jobs more in the future than immediate.
Mr. Chair and Representative Lucheski, Representative Dabney, mm-hmm. Does it say in the bill, and I've been trying to find it, that the jobs that are created with the tax credit have to be created here, or just that at least 50% of the business's jobs getting the credit and 1% of the payroll have to be in Minnesota?
Representative Dabney, did you want to take
yes.
that? Okay.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you. It specifies that in order for the credit to continue, the 51%, as Chair Lucheski indicated, 51% of the jobs created by the company and 51% of the payroll, which are, of course, different questions, have to be within the state of Minnesota. It's a recognition that you may have a consultant from outside who is receiving compensation for their efforts. Some activities of the company may occur in other states, but this is for small Minnesota businesses to stay here, to build here in Minnesota.
Chair, Representative, and I like that part of it. I like all the criteria here. I'm just asking the question because I haven't seen that specific language. And I raise the issue because If some of you that have been on the tax committee remember a few years back when we invested both taconite tax dollars and deed 21st century dollars in a company and did the research and got the pilot plant to work, and then the company said they were going to build a plant in Indiana. So I'm asking the question because I really still don't see it in here, but I'll assume that it is. The second question I have then, if that's the case, is how long do these jobs have to stay in Minnesota? Is it a 1 year? Do they have to keep them 1 year? Do they have to keep them 2 years? Do they have to keep them 3 years? Or can they just get the credit and then a year later lay people off?
I think Representative Dabney will answer your question, or he's testing the wind direction. I'm not sure which.
I think he wants to fill his
finger. It's the hot air.
No.
Testing the direction of the hot air, Mr. Chair. Representative Bukovina, I'd direct you to page eight, yeah. Lines 14 and down from there, which is the clawback, the revocation of the credit. Keep in mind that the credit goes not to the business but to the investor. But the clawback applies to the business. And so if they fail on those job and payroll requirements within 5 years, there is a clawback. And it's graduated. You see that, or I guess not graduated, declining on lines 23 through 30. And then there's some further language below that related to the clawback.
Okay. Thank you for reassuring me of that, because, as I said, I've seen things happen.
Mm-hmm.
Regarding, finally, the
Representative Rukavina, Representative Lencheski may have had something to add to that particular question if you're moving on to something else.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Rukavina, I would have pointed you to page 8 as well on the clawback, and that's an important piece for us to have, and we should not be afraid to have them or apologetic about them, because they ensure that Minnesotans have some guarantee that their money is actually going to go where they thought it was going to go, because this is coming from everyone else. But I would say it would not be honest of me to tell you that that is not the goal of this angel credit. And I have not been a strong advocate, as you know, but in how it's designed, is not to say that someday when that company grows up and is successful and becomes a big, sprawling company, there is no attempt to keep it necessarily in Minnesota. That really is not the goals of an angel credit. So down the road, you know, you're giving them, you're taking this money and you're giving it to these investors, knowing that they're going to have some strikeouts, but they're going to have some home runs, and hopefully the payoff will be big enough that you will begin to grow a lot of companies here. Will some later, at some other point, long after the clawback has expired, get bigger and maybe move somewhere? Yes. I mean, that can happen. We hope it doesn't. But it's almost impossible to write something to ensure that that early stage investment that grows into a Medtronic could never leave or something, you know. So that's part of the problem with trying to figure out how to construct it. So I don't want to leave an impression that the clawback alone would suffice forever. It wouldn't.
Well, Madam Chair, members, and I appreciate that, Representative Lucheski. You know, Laura, Representative Solberg and I have been working on trying to replace the, you know, 20,000 jobs that we've lost up north at minimum since both of us got elected. And, you know, we've had failures. Well, we had a devastating 1980 and the lost, you know, 15,000 taconite jobs and the probably 15,000 at the time jobs that went with them in the, you know, ancillary businesses. And we've been working on economic development for years, and we have put those types of clawback clauses in there, Representative Lencheski, and I think it's good to have them in there. But, you know, it doesn't hurt to try to keep those other jobs that may spin off and be created someday, to try to keep them here, because the public is making an investment. But I appreciate that. But the last thing I have is about the, you know, this bogus acronym for CARS, Z or whatever it is. But in any event, it's a good project, and I'm glad to see that, you know, we're trying to keep good manufacturing jobs in Minnesota, because when Ford Motor Company first announced, I scrambled with the auto workers to try to save those jobs and really didn't get much help from many people in St. Paul except Representative Mariani to try to do what we had done to save that plant. But, you know, we've had a little reprieve on those jobs, but I'm wondering, first of all, I'm curious, how much does Ford Motor Company pay in taxes imposed under Chapter 290 on line 336.5? Do you know, Mr. Representative? Mr. Michaels, does anybody know what Ford Motor Company pays in taxes now?
Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rukavina, obviously the corporate franchise tax liability is confidential, and so only the Department of Revenue knows for sure. However, public SEC reports indicate the company has not been profitable for quite a while, and so I would expect they're not paying any corporate franchise tax, and probably won't for a while until those carryover losses are used up, but that's speculation. So the more advantageous part of this package would be the property tax, sales tax, and refundable jobs credits provisions.
And members, I like the jobs credit, and I think it's good, but again, is there a clawback clause in here that, or can you give them a credit for 1 year and then they shut it down?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Lincheski.
Representative Rukavina, Mr. Chair. We modeled this after the way the governor did it and the way Job Z is and working with St. Paul. And so, you know, Mr. Michael can, I think the hard part with this one is, you know, will this even be enough?
Well,
I don't know.
You know what?
So how it cycles through, you know, that's the trick is what.
And I don't mind trying to keep good manufacturing jobs there. You know, when we had this a couple of years ago, there was a debate that over putting green jobs and just tearing the place down and building condos on the river, which is a good thing we didn't do it because there's nobody left in this town and in this state to buy a condo on the river because we don't make anything anymore. So the issue is to try to keep these jobs here. Now, I think the best way to do it is for us to do something on top of this, and that is to look at trying to create a market with Ford. You know, if you required that we had electric trucks by our local units of government, which Representative Mariani had a bill, and I believe Representative Hornstein and myself, and you just required that we had local units of government in the state buy 3,000 of them a year for the next few years at $16,000 a truck, and there's auto workers out there. What's a Ford Ranger cost? $16,000? I don't know. What does it cost? You guys get a cheaper discount, but what does it cost? $16,000, and you sold 3,000, 9,000 of them over 3 years, that's a $144 million market. You know, that's a good way to look at it. Now, I know my friends on the other side of the aisle might talk about, you know, us going in concert with the corporate America to do some corporate type of capitalism, but I might remind you that many of you over there voted for ethanol, as your governor voted for ethanol, and that many of you over there voted for 25 and 25 as your governor is touting as his most creative environmental thing that he's done. So, you know, on top of this, Madam Chair, I think you need maybe to think about the fact that maybe we should think about doing some mandates like that to guarantee that the market's going to be there to keep Ford Motor Company or anybody else that wants to build electric trucks to meet a mandate that we set in this state to clean the environment and keep jobs here.
Very good. Representative Lincheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Rukavina. And again, that isn't the purview of this committee. Other committees could take a look at that, but that's not a tax item. I will say that the United Auto Workers are here and represent Paymar, St. Paul, and we can hear from them too. I do know I spoke with Mr. Gross after the last hearing, who could give incredible detail on what truck costs what and what the mileage is and what kind of engine, and so I'm sure all that information is available from the folks who are here to talk about the proposal with us tonight.
Well,
Representative Rukavina.
You know, and again, we want to keep the jobs here. I've certainly been trying to do that for years with the auto workers, and I'm glad to see the St. Paul delegation coming on board now and realizing that, you know, manufacturing jobs are more important than condos on the river that nobody can afford anymore. But I represent Paymar. How you doing? Anyway, you know, but still, the market we got to create. We mandated 25 and 20.
nothing wrong with mandating 3,000 trucks a year in 2015 or 2012 or whatever to keep those jobs here, because these tax, the 1,875,000 or if there's 1,000 people there, $2 million isn't going to keep Ford Motor Company running that plant. I can tell you that right now.
Say, before we go any further, I just was wanted to get show of hands of people who wanted to give public testimony in this bill. And is there anyone from like Mankato? Just want to make sure we get people who are that far away to speak on any TIF. Okay. I had Representative Coles to that point and Representative Mullery, and maybe we could hear from some of the cities about and others about public testimony.
Mr. Chair, I'll prefer to yield my time to people who are going to inform us about something instead of engaging in the rhetoric with my friend Representative Rukavina.
Thank you kindly. My wife thinks you think. Think I said I'd be home by 8.
Bring it on, big boy. That black eye you had last week.
Okay, Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And parking lots that way,
my,
by the way.
My question has changed a lot from when I first had, about a half hour ago, had the question, and now I'm beginning to wonder if the real Representative Lencheski was captured and by an alien or something. I've always been much more liberal on using TIF for more economic development, but never quite as far as my understanding now. I didn't realize, but that was my initial question, and now it's answered, is it can be used for stadium, Rossino, and all kinds of things. So you have really gone the opposite way. But now, since I got the answer to that, I have a new question. Why on the angel credits don't we require more jobs in this state? Like some states require 80%, and we're only at 50%. If we're doing this to get more jobs in this state, shouldn't we be looking at getting 80% or something like that?
Representative Lencheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't think you can do a stadium or Rossino under here, because you'd have to break ground by July of 2011. So that'd be, if someone can tell me that that could happen, we'll have to have an amendment here to make sure that can't happen. But I expressly don't think that could happen. But on the jobs count, you know, we talked about that a little bit. Maybe Representative Dabney wants to jump in. I mean, you know, again, I think the angel credit, unlike most of the other things in the bill, is actually, you know, trying to get an early stage investment. So the jobs come later, not sooner in the process, and that's different than most of the rest of the bill. And that's acknowledged in the bill, but that's to try to stimulate jobs in that sector as well. But to the actual job count, I mean, we feel good that we got a report in, a sunset, and a clawback. And these are critical accountability pieces for the legislature going forward. We've spent time on tax expenditures in this committee. And I know Representative Pepin is the chief author of a bill that sunsets everything, and I'm with her on that. And I think if we're going to start new things, we need to sunset them too and get a report back and see if they're working. And in that, we'll see the kind of jobs it's created. But beyond, you know, 50 or 80%, I don't have the answer to that. I'd let the advocates who are here to testify on it maybe answer that more directly.
Representative Dabney, your name was mentioned. I didn't know if you wanted to add anything.
Mr. Chair, and just in response to Representative Mullery, two things. One, I think some of these businesses, as the scenario I touched on earlier, by the nature of the technology and the science they're applying, may have particularly payroll elsewhere because they're new, they're innovative, and there's probably precious few people who understand what they're doing. And some of those folks may be living in other states and consulting or being involved in that way. Secondly, the language that you're seeing in this bill was put together over long months of negotiations and discussion, principally looking to what would make Minnesota both comparable and competitive with the many other states with angel investment tax credits. So I think what you're seeing here is reflective of what you're going to find in many of the other states in terms of requirements on the businesses and on the investors.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Lencheski. I apologize, I was caught in another committee before this, so maybe you've covered it, but I wanted to, for the record, make sure that the qualified green building and sustainable design projects, as I read it, nothing in the language prohibits retrofitting an existing building if it meets the green standards that are referenced here, but I just wanted to have that assurance because the wording, you know, could be read a couple of different ways in terms of building meaning from scratch as opposed to retrofitting. There's no language that refers to that. My understanding is that the LEED standards are, they are developing rehab standards, and quite honestly, I've been convinced that the greenest building you can do is one in which you are reusing an existing structure because you're not, you know, having to harvest additional new wood, make new aluminum struts if it's a commercial building, all those, that kind of remanufacturing of things that otherwise would end up in a landfill. And so I just want to make sure that as you're interpreting this or intending it, retrofitting of an existing building to these kind of high standards of environmental improvement would qualify.
Representative Lencheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Loeffler, I think you're talking about page 25 and 26, and I don't see anything about that. I'm happy to work with you on that. We are trying to encourage vertical new construction, but the historic credit is actually trying to fix up all kinds of older things as well, so I think we're trying to get everything done. I would like to learn more about that maybe after public testimony, because I have heard that the Senate has introduced something else, and I just want to say for the record right now for members and the public, there is not going to be a tax conference committee on this, so working to get things done with the Senate isn't going to help you. You got to have it done in this committee with this group first, because the bill we send out, that if there are amendments on the House floor, that is the bill. And so we're hoping to have a very bipartisan, strong agreement with both bodies here. So I understand the Senate is looking at sort of undoing those sort of green standards, but I'm not certain of that. I don't know if there's been language put in on that, but I've heard some rumors here and there about a number of provisions, and people need to get that to the House so that the House can understand the arguments on both sides of that.
So, and Representative Loeffler, maybe you could talk to Representative Kalin over there offline. I know he's probably has some detailed answers for you, but...
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will definitely follow through on that, and I appreciate that. I just know there are existing buildings that would not meet historic structure designation, but that would be capable of generating significant employment in the retrofitting. Just maybe you'd use the shell of the building.
I think Representative Kalin could add a little bit more, and we'd like to get to public testimony, so as concise as you can be would be great.
I can be very brief, Mr. Chair. Representative Jeremy Kalin. Representative Loeffler, I would just direct you to pages 11 through 14, which are the kind of meat of the property assessed clean energy provisions that, and then sections 9 and 10, starting on page 20, are the special assessment authority to which those two sections relate, and those don't require, those just are the voluntary assessments where the capital is amortized like you do on sidewalk improvements, or even actually the skyways in downtown Minneapolis, I understand, were financed that way several decades ago. So between the provision that you asked about, the historic tax credit and the property assessed clean energy, I think that most construction opportunities in Minnesota could be financed in some way in this bill.
Thank you very much. We'd like to do some public testimony now. We don't have a list necessarily, but maybe if we could start with anybody who's from outside the Twin Cities Metro. I saw North Mankato in the bill. I didn't know if there's anyone who came from that area. But otherwise, come on up if you'd like to give public testimony on the bill. And Representative Lencheski, I assume your goal here is we'll, after we take public testimony, we'll lay the bill over and then take Representative Mullery's bill and then be out of here, and then tomorrow we'll discuss your bill further. Very good. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Bonnie McDonald. I'm the Executive Director of the Preservation Alliance of Minnesota. And today I'm here with several of my colleagues to speak in favor of the credit for historic rehabilitation, Section 5 of the bill, which you have talked about today. I would like to thank, sincerely thank, Representative Lincheski, because as she said, this was quite a move to include a tax credit for historic structure rehabilitation as well as this grant program. And we appreciate the opportunity to work with the HUC research staff as well as Representative Lincheski to make this bill as best as possible. I'd also like to thank Representative Marquardt for his carrying this bill for a number of years. So thank you for his leadership as well. We are here today to support passage of the State Historic Rehabilitation Tax Credit as a job creation tool. On behalf of the Building Jobs Coalition, representing the labor, contractor, and design industries, we thank you for including this important provision to stimulate construction activity across the state. Minnesota is only one of 10 states in the nation that does not have a state historic rehabilitation tax credit. Every one of our neighbors in the upper Midwest that taxes income has this incentive to stimulate sustainable development and create green jobs. Investors are leaving our state and taking the leverage of a mirroring federal credit with them while development opportunities languish vacant or underutilized in our communities. The proposal is for a 20% state income tax credit that would pair with the federal 20% rehabilitation tax credit on qualified construction expenditures, as you've read in the fact sheet that we passed out. It would be eligible for National Register properties only, and the Minnesota State Historic Preservation Office, which Ms. Manzi had mentioned, would administer both the federal and the state credit, creating an administrative efficiency and maximizing the state's investment. The proposed state historic tax credit would leverage additional federal dollars and bring those resources to Minnesota. The Minnesota Historical Society created a chart that we have passed out for you showing the leverage of the federal rehabilitation dollars that come into our region. We currently rank 22nd in the nation for use of the federal credit, while our neighbor to the south, Missouri, ranks number one. Now that translates to $45 million in federal money for Minnesota and $534 million for Missouri. Missouri's state historic tax credit, on which ours is modeled, was passed in 1997 and since then has generated $1.37 billion in public and private investment since then. So in just the first 4 years of their tax credit, just to let you know, Missouri created almost 7,000 new jobs through historic preservation and returned $4 for every $1 spent to the taxpayer. Three quarters of that income was returned to the state in sales tax and income tax prior to the allocation of the credits. So I assure you that the jobs that are created here and the historic buildings will all stay in Minnesota. The Preservation Alliance of Minnesota has been advocating for the historic credit since 1998 to retain jobs and private investment in our state. This is a wise investment in our communities because historic preservation creates more jobs per dollar output and is inherently more labor intensive. Just to give you an example, in Minnesota, for every $1 million of output, the historic tax credit would create 5.7 more jobs than manufacturing, 4 more jobs than road construction, and 2 more jobs than new construction. Additionally, this is very, very low cost per job at $7,000, we estimate. And we calculate that this provision will create about 1,500 construction jobs annually at a minimum. And those are green jobs. As Representative Loeffler said, the greenest building is the building already built. And so we can create sustainable development through this project. And if I may, Representative Solberg's question about construction jobs, this is not only the direct construction jobs created, but we also do consider induced jobs. So for the project in Crookston, we're creating 76 construction jobs, but also keeping people downtown in that housing so that they can also support the pharmacy and the grocery store and the restaurants there as well. And those are the induced jobs. You heard from Rick Collins of Ryan Company several weeks ago during a hearing about TIF that it can be very difficult to put together a historic preservation project because we don't have this gap financing tool. Historic development projects statewide are languishing because we don't have this incentive. And the state historic tax credit would incentivize quality community projects, not only in the Twin Cities, but statewide, in places like we know of projects in Duluth, Crookston, St. Cloud, Sleepy Eye, Albert Lea, and many others. We urge you to pass the state historic rehabilitation tax credit as part of the state's job creation strategy. And I thank you for your support of this vital provision and would like to ask the colleagues that are here with me today to speak to specific pieces of the bill in their area of expertise. And we would all be very happy to take your questions. Thank you for your time.
Could I interrupt? Thank you, Ms. McDonald. Representative Reinhart had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. McDonald, do you have a ballpark estimate of what the inventory is of projects? You mentioned Duluth, which is my city, and I'm familiar with the projects in my backyard, but I'm not familiar with what the state inventory might be.
Ms. McDonald.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Representative Reinhart, the properties that are eligible for this credit are limited only to the National Register listed properties. In Minnesota, that encompasses 1,600 listings, which is expanded out to about 7,000 properties. Now, not all of those are ready for development, of course. We know of probably dozens at this point that would be either shovel-ready or are in development, pre-development. So the revenue estimate that you see here, you can see that it ramps up from about $4 million to $10 million with the cap that has been proposed. So we know that there are always going to be that number of projects that we can afford this time. I mean, in your district, we certainly have a couple of great projects online. The St. Louis County Jail has just been purchased, and the Duluth Armory as well.
Familiar with both.
Yes.
I had a quick question on your chart. Ohio has this big spike and then a big drop-off. Do you know why that is? Did they have a credit phase out? Or?
Mr. Chair, thank you for the question. Ohio passed their state historic preservation tax credit, I believe, 1 year ago, 2 years ago. So that is a good question that we need to ask Ohio. As we had said, the developers lined up like they were camping out for Twins tickets for this. They exhausted the credit the first day that it was available. So that may have something to do with it.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I am not Rick Collins. my name is Kit Richardson, and I am a co-owner and principal of Schaefer Richardson Real Estate Company. I'm a registered architect, a real estate developer, a licensed building contractor, and a licensed real estate sales agent. So this recession has been and continues to be difficult for me, our employees, and our business. Schaefer Richardson is a small 18-person real estate development company focused on urban infill sites with a special interest in and affinity for historic buildings. We have won a number of awards for our renovation work and are now involved in our largest project to date, East Bank Mills, which includes a number of historic buildings along with the national landmark structure, the Pillsbury A Mill, which is the largest flour mill in the world when it was built in the 1880s. I'd like to make 3 points briefly, read a few sentences from the National Trust report that I received this morning, and then answer any questions you might have. First, historic preservation, by definition, is extremely expensive. Much of the work has to be done on site, by hand, by highly skilled construction workers. The good news is that preservation employs a lot of skilled, highly paid people. The bad news, of course, is that means it's very, very expensive. In addition, the Secretary of Interior standards are rigorous. They are now being applied to both the exterior and interiors of buildings. That was not true 10, 15 years ago when I did my first historic renovation project. And they can easily add more to the cost of the project, those guidelines, than can be made up by the federal 20% historic tax credit. As an example, the cost to restore the landmark Pillsbury A Mill will be more than double the cost to build a new building of comparable size, and it will be the most costly preservation we have ever done on a cost per square foot basis. Second, we are living in a very strange economic and financial times. I've been in real estate since 1974. I've never seen a market like this. Both the debt markets and the equity capital markets are essentially frozen. We are told this is due partly to federal regulators requiring greater capital reserves, so banks are hoarding, not lending. If and when banks consider lending, they're requiring extraordinary amounts of equity and providing much lower levels of debt. As a general rule, debt is cheaper than equity. So a reduction in debt further exacerbates the problem of raising equity. Not only do you have to raise more equity, it costs more money to do so. Equity investors are similarly on the sidelines, waiting to see if the market has hit bottom. They do not want to be the first to jump back into a falling market. Better to be second, third, or even fourth to come back into a rising market. There's a herd mentality in real estate just as there is in the stock market. As a result, even sound, viable projects require additional sources of capital, and this does not appear to be changing yet. Interest rates are low. Cost of construction has leveled off, in some cases gotten less, in some cases it's risen a little bit. And as importantly, demand seems to be ticking up, but we cannot raise capital to design and develop. As one example, we are now hearing that HUD may only finance one project in Minnesota this year. My third and last point, the historic tax credit offers a known and reliable source of equity when paired with a federal 20% historic tax credit. Those two credits together can fill the equity gap for most, if not all, projects, in my opinion. If we use the federal tax credit as our model, the state credit actually makes the federal credit more valuable, and more investment dollars will flow to the state. Because of the significant cost of historic renovation, because of the stringent guidelines applied and enforced by the National Park Service, guidelines that we all agreed to abide by the way, and because capital markets are still on the sidelines for the most part, and because of the extra time associated with preservation projects, a state tax credit is critical to the successful start and completion of Minnesota's historic preservation projects. All of us in all of the industries I represent, design, development, and construction urge you to pass this important piece of legislation. This morning I received a copy of the first annual report of the economic impact of the federal historic tax credit. It was produced by the National Trust Community Investment Corporation in conjunction with Rutgers School of Public Planning and Public Policy. I just want to read three or four sentences. And this is a study that looks at both the impact of the federal tax credit and then the impact of the tax credit as enacted in various states. They actually focus on 10 states. At the federal level, the federal tax credit over the fiscal years 1978 when it started to 2008 cost the U.S. Treasury $16.6 billion, inflation adjusted in 2008 dollars, estimated total federal tax receipts, generated by the HTC over that same time period were $21 billion, indicating that the Federal Historic Tax Credit is a revenue raiser. Then at the state level, they looked at Kansas, the state of Kansas. A $1 million investment in historic rehabilitation in Kansas realizes a markedly better economic effect to Kansas with respect to employment income, gross state product, GSP, and state local taxes compared to a similar increment of investment, $1 million, in an array of residential and non-residential new construction, including building highways, or a $1 million investment in an array of business activities important in Kansas, such as manufacturing, electrical machinery and automobile, agriculture, wheat farming, and services, telecommunications. And then finally, in the 21 years that Kansas did not have a state historic tax credit, the 21 years from 1981 to 2001, Kansas completed 50 historic tax credit projects with an aggregate value of $113.7 million in inflation-adjusted dollars. In the 8 years since the adoption of the Kansas Historic Tax Credit, 2002 to 2009, a total of 540 tax credit-aided projects, averaging 68 projects a year, have been completed, representing an aggregate investment of $271 million. Averaging $33 million per year. Huge change in the investment that has been made in the state of Kansas on the basis of a state tax credit paired with a federal credit. Thank you very much. I'll let other people speak.
Thanks very much. Any questions for Mr. Richardson? Representative Downey.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't have a lot of history with these kinds of credits and historic projects, but you mentioned that a historic project costs roughly twice what the development of a similar structure new would be. Is that inclusive of kind of demolition of the old structure and building a new one, or is that just comparing it to a new development in an office park out in the suburbs or something? Could you give just a little more information on the relative cost of these historic projects?
Sure. Mr. Chair,
the cost of the Pillsbury A Mill, the project, a building that we own, the National Landmark, the cost of renovating that building on a per square foot basis will be more than twice the cost to build from new a new building, not including the cost of land. So the building is approximately 150,000 square feet. It'll cost about twice. As Bonnie McDonald pointed out, however, in spite of the extraordinary costs, which the tax credits can help offset, not completely offset, it is the green thing to do. Not only is it a national landmark structure, it is in the center of the city. It is an existing building, so the embodied energy there is just phenomenal. But I would say, as a general statement, over and above the Pillsbury A Mill project specifically, the cost of renovation typically is much higher than the cost of building new. One of the reasons is that there is so much specialized work done by workers who have very special skills, and a lot of the work will be done by hand. At the Pillsbury A Mill, as an example, we have to tear out the every floor at every level by hand. It's all wood. We have to replace that floor with a new structure. All of the walls have to be drilled. Anchor bolts have to be set by hand very carefully. So it's just, it is, as a generalization, it's very expensive work.
Mr. Chair, thank
you. As a follow-up, Representative Downey.
Quick follow-up, thank you. How about an ongoing operational basis? Are they equally more expensive to maintain and operate on an ongoing basis?
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Richardson,
I don't think I would generalize on that. I mean, if you look at a building holistically, I start with does it exist or not, and where does it exist? If it's an existing building far out and there are huge transportation costs for employees to get there and back, I mean, all those things I think have to be taken into account. It also depends on the systems that are installed in the building. As I think many people in the room know, we intend to use river water to heat and cool the A Mill. We intend to install a hydroelectric generator in the basement. We hope that the Pillsbury A Mill will be totally self-contained, totally green. Actually, we hope to sell energy back out to some of the neighboring buildings. In that particular case, that will be the greenest building in the state of Minnesota.
Mr. Chair. If you want to move on, I can defer.
I think
we've got one final question, and I hope
we may have some other historic preservation folks still too. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair. What percentage of these projects end up being residential use as compared to commercial or other industrial?
Mr. Richardson,
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure I can answer that. Our company does both residential and commercial. Most of the rehabilitation projects that we've done have been commercial. The Pillsbury A Mill will be commercial, not residential. But maybe Bonnie or John or someone else could answer that question better than I. Thank you.
Thank you. If you could state or identify yourself for the record, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Norm Jones. I'm with the law firm of Winthrop & Weinstein. Our firm has helped developers and investors close over 500 tax credit transactions in 38 states. I'm here to talk about a very narrow aspect of this bill, which is how, if enacted, the investor community would deal with this bill. Would it be efficient in the sense that for a given dollar of credit, how many cents would go into the real project we're trying to encourage? That's that's one definition of efficiency. And I'm just here to talk about that or any other technical aspects. One thing we've learned in all our tax credit transactions is not all tax credits have equal value. despite best intentions of the drafters and creators, on occasion the credit has a flaw, and it could be any flaw, that translates into the industry not paying enough, the perceived enough for this credit. So that's something that we took a look at the current proposed amendment with an eye toward eliminating anything that could be inefficient, proposing some things that would make this credit more efficient. So if so that the state is getting the most bang for its buck, so to speak. The top, if I were to name three top hallmarks of an efficient state credit, it would be, number one, predictability. And I understand that predictability is only so good as the budget will allow. But to the extent that you have a permanent credit, and to the extent that developers can rely on a determination that they've got the credit before they start building the project, that's predictability. Second hallmark would be the efficient tax consequences. And this bleeds over into having enough different possibilities in your credit so that different developments with different parties involved can mix and match and achieve the greatest efficiency for their circumstances. And the third hallmark would be trying to reach the broadest possible investor pool. The last thing you want to do is spend a dollar in tax credit but have a very narrow audience that's trying to buy it. That goes to expanding the credit against premium tax. And in our experience, insurance companies have been very active buyers of credits. So if you're going to spend a dollar, let's make the widest audience we can to buy these credits. Testing this draft, or testing the proposed amendment against those three hallmarks, and having had a chance with some of my colleagues to provide feedback about efficiency, in my opinion, this draft has all the earmarks of the most efficient structure of tax credit that the industry will probably accept right now. And I don't know if we need to get into any details, but that is our conclusion, that it allows enough flexibility for different parties and different investors to match up, make efficient tax consequences choices, have some predictability, and also reach the broadest possible investor pool. If there are any questions about the any technical aspects, I'd be happy to get up again and perhaps
very
address
good.
Those. Thank
any
you.
Questions
for
Mr. Jones. Representative Loon.
Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Jones, or whoever may want to answer this. I just had a question about the grant in lieu of credit option. And is that something that was sort of borrowed from one of the other states that offers these? And how would that work as compared to just the straight-up tax credit?
Mr. Jones.
I'll give you some information about that, although I don't know the genesis of why that was included in this particular bill. That is probably best viewed as an improvement on the typical. A typical state credit would be a credit or a refundable credit, and the industry right now knows how to deal with that and with known tax consequences. But how I view the grant option is two things. Number one, it's possible that the grant could be more efficient in some circumstances. We could dream up a circumstance under which a grant is actually more efficient than the other options. And number two, it provides a baseline value so that if all the other circumstances are less efficient, the grant is at least a known quantity of 90 cents, so that it provides a baseline assurance that you're that amount of money will at least get into projects. Perhaps the other options could achieve better than 90 cents, but at least a 90 cent minimum. And that eliminates some of the risk that we've unintentionally created an inefficient credit, in my mind.
Very good. Thanks very much. The next testifier, welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Herman. I'm a partner at Fagry & Benson and work in the real estate finance and development area. So in a number of cases, Mr. Jones on my right and I are on the opposite sides of the table. I have the developer and he has the Historic Tax Credit Fund as a client, and we're negotiating about the investment in the project. I've done perhaps a dozen, 15 historic credit deals for developers in our market over the years, including several larger buildings like the Ivy Tower in downtown Minneapolis. And I have a number of projects that are, in a sense, waiting in the wings, ready to go if they could reach the equity threshold that the marketplace seems to require now. I'd like to echo his comments generally. We have had a chance to work with Representative Lencheski and the staff, and she has pushed hard on us and I think on the advocates about how to make the credit more efficient to accomplish grant-like levels in terms of the efficiency of the dollars that are spent. And we do think that the credit, because of the way it is structured, will accomplish the 85, 90 cent kind of returns that are seen in the most efficient of these credits in other marketplaces. I think in spite of the fact that in theory you can say that a grant program would have better efficiency, I think there are good reasons why it makes sense to consider a tax credit rather than a grant where there's a companion federal grant that you can help to attract to the state. And I know you could argue that the federal grant might come, or the federal credit might come with grant projects as well, but I think there are terrific efficiencies for the investors in being in a project that has both a state and a federal credit. I think it actually adds investors to the marketplace, particularly investors who have state tax issues, who are localized in the state and are interested consequently in the federal credit then because they're interested in buying the state credit. I believe that there are at least two investment houses in Minnesota that if we had a state credit would try to generate an internal program for the state of marketing those credits. We have none right now. All of the credit buyers that I've ever dealt with, and I think all the ones Norm represents, except for a couple of tiny direct deals I've done, have always been with investment funds that are domiciled outside of Minnesota. And I think that it would add more market discipline to the investment decision making by these companies, which is a benefit in terms of the quality of the projects. So if you might get 5 or 10 or 15 cent better efficiency with a complete grant, you wouldn't have a second investor looking at the deal itself and saying, yeah, that's a pretty good deal, I'm interested in doing it. So Representative Lencheski's worked hard with us. We think the version you have in front of you, frankly, an improvement over the old version, and I hope the committee will support it. Let me make two other points, one in response to Representative Loon's question about the 90-cent grant in lieu of the payment. Obviously, you have to be a taxpayer to take advantage of the tax credit part of the bill. I think there actually are some substantial nonprofit organizations that have community reinvestment objectives in their immediate activity area. Not that I know this is the case, but allow me to make an example that we would all understand. Alina Hospitals obviously have the Abbott Hospital, and it's right next to the Midtown Exchange Project, which was a credit project that happened a couple of years ago with federal credits. I could easily imagine how, with a grant in lieu of tax credit program, Alina might have said, we can find an investment here because we actually make a little money on it, and we would then be a logical partner for a project like the Midtown Exchange in their immediate location, because often these projects are in areas which are economically distressed. They're center city or they're downtown, they're near existing institutional entities, and so I think this grant has great appeal by making it available to the nonprofit investment entity, which currently wouldn't have any way to use the credit. It's kind of like another group of investors on top of the insurance companies that we get when we add the insurance premium tax. And I also want to point out that the historic credit is available in pairing with low-income housing credits. And a question was asked by Representative a minute ago, how much of it is housing and how much is non-housing? Actually, it's been running close to 50-50, about 45% more or less most years housing and the balance non-housing. But in 2009, housing took a big dip because, as I think we all know, many low-income projects weren't able to happen because the credit market evaporated when Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were out of the market and the market hadn't stabilized. You can use this credit with low-income projects. In fact, I would say in our office, the majority of projects we've done have been paired with low-income housing tax credits, and so it will stretch our low-income housing tax credits further, and I think consequently will have a secondary beneficial effect. So that's a big advantage.
Thank you, Mr. Herman. Any questions for Mr. Herman? Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Other public testifiers, come on down.
Hello,
hi, please identify yourself for the committee.
My name is Noel Labine. I'm director of the Wright County Economic Development, and I'm speaking on behalf of EDAM and the Minnesota Association of County Economic Developers. I want to praise this committee and the efforts of these legislators, of this legislation to create more jobs in Wright County. There's a number of tools in your bill which are going to be very useful for people that work in economic development. I've helped a number of companies through the year. I've made introductions to innovative entrepreneurs, to angel investment tax or angel investors, and have had a lot of no's. I've watched a couple of companies leave the state, but I also have helped companies that have stayed here because they were able to get some of these this equity investments. So it's very worthwhile. We're very much in favor of the angel investment tax.
Very good. You said you're the county economic development officials, or
yeah,
that was the
actually it's called MAPSED. Minnesota Association of Professional County Economic Developers.
Very good. Thank you. Yeah. Questions for Mr. Bine, is it?
Labine.
Thanks very much.
Okay.
Other testimony. Welcome to the committee. If you could identify yourself for the tape, please.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is Gene Winstead, Mayor of the City of Bloomington.
My name is Bill Griffith with Larkin Hoffman Law Firm representing Mall of America. Thank you.
And we would be here tonight to speak to the provisions in the bill and like to thank Representative Lencheski for including a lot of clarifying things that can only work to help what goes on at the Mall of America and help some development in that arena. So we are here to, it's been framed and we're here to support that. And if there's any questions?
Questions to Mayor Winstead or Mr. Griffith? Related to the mall.
Mr. Chair and members, I just want to answer the question earlier this evening. We did have a project labor agreement. In fact, all of the 20 years that the mall has been around and has been essentially under construction for all of those years. There's a lot of work that's done each year. Each year as tenants change over, and so we've always had a project labor agreement in place, and we're very proud of that work with the building trades.
Representative Broad and then Representative Reinert.
Mr. Chairman, I'll defer to the Vice Chairman first.
Please.
Thank you.
First.
Wow. Well, Mr. Chairman, I guess I'll answer my question.
Okay.
Wow. Thank you. You know, I'm just curious related to the retail market itself. You know, the mall has had some pretty aggressive plans and I think has done a great job kind of presenting those plans to the legislature over the years. Has the model changed?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Broad,
Mr. Griffin.
The model has not changed. The mall really has conceived phase two, where the additional phases is being complementary, not competitive, to the phases that are built there today. And so, for instance, Bass Pro is an anchor you've heard about. We want to get when families come, we want to make sure Dad also stays and and shops. And so it's complementary, not competitive to what's there. But we will say and very directly say that it's a tougher market to attract retail. And so that's why the project has to be constructed in phases, not all at once, as phase two was envisioned just a few years ago. So this language is really technical, it's clarifying, and it gives us that flexibility to work with the city to bring about the project over several phases.
And Mr. Chairman, just one quick question. Has the recreational components changed at all, or are those still part of the plan?
The plan contains recreational components, entertainment components, retail components, and also hotel and hospitality components. Again, rather than one large bill, though, it would occur over several phases.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Representative Reinert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Either for Mayor Winstead or Mr. Griffith, I think the mall was the ground was broken for the Mall of America project when I was still in junior high, so I'm not sure I know all the history, but I know Representative Lincheski referred to flexibility regarding phase one, and in the bill I read a lot of phase two language. Can you just give us a very brief synopsis on phase one, phase two? Are there other phases? Just trying to get big picture on this.
Mayor Winstead.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Reiner, Mall of America goes back to development, and I was there, believe it or not. I was a planning commissioner in the city of Bloomington at that time, and it was always envisioned to be two large phases coming out of the ground at the Mall of America, with the first phase coming out in one piece like you see it today. Phase two was always intended to be something in the neighborhood of 4 to 5 million square feet of development added to that. And what we learned over time from a perspective is that we're looking for some flexibility in this language that's in this bill now does clear that up a little bit. And what we found out is that in order to connect phase one to phase two, there would be construction on phase one site that wouldn't be eligible for some TIF. So if this were to be the case and we meld them together better, it would really help in the development of it, as well as some of the construction will be done on the phase one site, even though it'll be considered phase two mall. And as it goes forward now, we've learned things over the last 20 years. So.
Quick follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Representative Reinert.
Mayor, is there a footprint for phase two? I mean, we can all envision now phase one as you've identified.
Phase one is what it is, and over time here, too, this is one of the things that's changed. It used to be, it was originally thought to be the land to the east of the Mall of America, but now, because of the airport runway protection zone, it has been shifted to the Met Center site. So the vast majority of phase two would be on the Met Center site, but connecting it to phase one on that north side of the Mall of America with some other development included also.
Thank you.
Very good. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair? Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Dabney. I'm sorry.
Sorry, guys.
Hold on, gentlemen.
I had one question. I now have two. If I'm understanding you correctly, instead of thinking of phase one and phase two, it's more phase one and phase 2A, and then phase 2B, and then phase 2C, excuse me, because you can't do all of phase two at once. If I'm correct in that, are the elements that are in Chair Lincheski's bill sufficient for 2A, 2B, and 2C, or can we expect your smiling faces back here in a couple of years looking for additional assistance, additional subsidy for the mall?
Mayor Winston.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dabney, I would love to come back and smile with you at any given time.
not that I don't enjoy the experience.
No, we see each other more frequently than even here. So.
We've got to stop meeting like
that. I think you're correct, and one of the things that it will come out in different portions of phase two, it may be a couple of large buildings and then some down the road as markets allow and conditions are there. And what we as the city see this flexibility going forward is to allow the public-private investment to be put forth and built as it comes out in phases in the appropriate proportion. So that is, I don't know if that directly answers your question, but we would envision it to, as you described, to be multiple segments of phase two coming forward, and that's why you'll see language in the bill that more or less states is all phases. So,
Mr. Chair,
Representative Dabney,
thank you, Mr. Mayor. I think I understand it's 2A, 2B, 2C, or however. What I'm not clear on is, are you coming back for more subsidies,
Mr. Chair and Representative? If we could have envisioned the airport expansion, if we could have envisioned TIF reform in 2001, if we could have envisioned the current downturn in the market, the answer would probably be no, but who knows what comes next. And so if we don't need to come back, great. If we do, it'll probably be as a result of something beyond our control.
Okay. Mr. Chair, one last.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. You'd indicated that most of Phase 2 will occur on the old Met Center site, and then you referred kind of obliquely with other development. And what is that other, what's the vision for that other development that apparently isn't Phase 2 but is somehow entangled,
Mr. Chairman,
a dimension of, sure. I'm not sure what
I understand what you're saying, Mr. Chairman, Representative Dabney. As I mentioned, if Phase 2 is the Met Center site, there will be connecting elements that will abut and really be adjoined to Phase 1 of the Mall of America, which would be technically on the Phase 1 tax increment finance district. So we're working to meld that together, as well as we've been working and talking regarding the development of an additional hotel on the Phase 1 site that would be considered a Phase 2 portion development. So that would be one of the areas that you could see some separate development.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Representative Mullery.
Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Winston. In the past, there were some protections for competition, I know, against the inner cities, such as Chanhassen or Theater, or I know, which would have affected both inner cities, or I think St. Paul was worried about a hockey rink, possibly a stadium there. Is there protections in this bill like there were in the other bills in the past for that, or if there isn't, are you willing to put those kind of things in?
Mayor Winstead.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mullery, those were provisions that were put in the bill 2 years ago that were not necessarily incorporated or adopted by the city when it took on that legislation, and no, there are none of those in this particular legislation now.
Mr. Chairman and members, all of the language that has been discussed with Representative Lencheski is in the nature of clarifications. There are no substantive changes to the bill from the 2008 legislation.
Very good. Other testifiers? Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Michael Schley. I'm also an attorney at Larkin Hoffman, but I'm here on my own behalf, not on behalf of a client. I've been practicing in the securities, corporate finance, public companies, mergers and acquisitions business for a little over 25 years. Before that, I had some time as an SEC enforcement person. I'm speaking as the angel tax credit tonight. I have to tell you first why this bill is of interest to me. Minnesota had a unique presence in the fundraising market. When I was at the commission, it stood out. Of the entire region that Chicago covered, there was no place like what we had here. There was a very special ability for young companies to go raise money. That's diminished dramatically as a result of a whole bunch of changes, not the subject here. And now it's much, much more difficult for the company that is founded by, run by, or the product that is invented by somebody who doesn't have a deep pocket. And one of the things that I would hope that the angel credit would do would be to help that sort of company, that sort of an issuer, have an opportunity to raise some funds. I won't say anything about certain parts of the bill. I'm not here to speak to, for example, what the rate should be, what the amount available should be, that sort of thing. I only want to speak to a few issues as to eligibility. I want to also mention that one of the reasons that I care, and one of the reasons I'm here without a client asking me to come here, is that I've had deals that I was trying to work on or that my clients were trying to be involved in that moved to Wisconsin or to Iowa. There were companies that were founded by people here that were looking to start their business here, but the offers they got made them say, we can't afford to stay here, and they moved across the border.
Some of them I've continued to work with, some of them not, but those are jobs that aren't here in Minnesota, and I feel badly about that. I could wish that this bill was broader in terms of what types of companies, what types of businesses, what types of investments, but I recognize the reality of what the funding is. Let me give you a few very specific recommendations. First of all, the bill as it's drafted now limits the credit to persons who are known as accredited investors. Securities laws require registration when you sell securities, or you have to meet an exemption. The concept of an accredited investor was an instrument that was created about 30 years ago to create a special category of investors for whom the law said they're more able to fend for themselves. You don't have to go through the full offering of a prospectus, etc. They're not somebody who should make a difference of whether or not they're investing in your deal. Now, there are numerous categories. The most common categories are people who have a net worth of more than $1 million or who have income of in excess of $200,000 in each of the last 3 years, or $300,000 if you're counting them on a married basis. The last time I was here and listening to the committee talking, one of the members spoke about the importance of this credit to the garage inventor. This bill doesn't go to the garage inventor. You can't go get this credit until you've gotten beyond that stage, until you're at the stage where you can go out to accredited investors and raise your money within 60 days. You have to have your product up and running. You have to be at a stage of expanding your business. You have to be at a stage of having something specific. If you're at an early stage company, you've invented the widget, you're trying to raise the money to manufacture a prototype, you're trying to figure out a way to solve technical problems, this bill doesn't do you any good. And I don't criticize what it does. I'm just saying I think that it needs to go farther. There are other categories of ways that people can invest in companies in compliance with the law without being accredited investors. I'll mention three of them, one of which I've long been an advocate for, but my analysis is true for all three. First of all, both the federal government, the SEC, and the states have a category of limited offering exemption where if the number of persons to whom you're selling your securities is very small, it's almost a gimme. You may have to file a notice form with the state, but it's not subject to an approval. Minnesota's is generally 10 people without even having to file a form. And that's without testing whether or not they are accredited. So if I'm forming a company and I pick up the phone and I call 10 of my best friends and say, listen, I'm trying to start this up. Here's my great idea. Can you each give me $25,000? I can do that. This bill isn't available. This credit would not be available for that inventor, that entrepreneur. The second category is you go a little farther. You can go out to about 35 people. You have to make a filing with the state. It's a relatively short form filing, far short of a prospectus. But once you've made that filing and the state has cleared it, you can go out and you can raise money from, again, the small number of investors. These are the ways that early stage companies typically raise their money, is through these sorts of exempt transactions. There's also a very special form of short form registration that Minnesota adopted a few years ago. I was one of the champions on that. It's called the Small Corporate Offering Registration. It's a hybrid between a public offering and a private placement. It's designed to allow people who have businesses who don't have wealthy friends and who don't have a broker willing to step up and help the market go out and raise their money publicly. They're allowed to do limited types of advertising. They're allowed to not be subject to a body count or number of investor count, and in turn not require that each investor write a check for $30,000 or some similar number. That kind of an offering would be ideal here. Let me tell you a couple of stories of clients that this bill would have helped. One was this one actually was not a client because we couldn't figure out a way to do the deal. It was a couple of people in a small town who had developed a way to take corn stalks,
put them in a machine similar to what you would use to make particle board and come out with a board that was not as strong as your normal particle board, but when you laid it on the floor near machines, it soaked up oil tremendously. So you didn't have to have somebody going around throwing it floor dry on the floor and sweeping it up every day and throwing it in the trash. You assembled these, you let them soak up, you pick them up with a forklift, you put them in a truck, and you haul them off to an incinerator or a power regeneration burner. It was a wonderful tool. The people doing it did not have access to accredited investors. If they took the list of everybody they knew, they only knew three or four people. They couldn't raise the money. Another company had a business that was a technology that they had developed that you could put oily things into the machine that they used, and it would extract the oil so that the oil was separate and the other items that were in the machine came out clean. The anticipation initially was floor dry. It's used now for oily rags, and they're located in Wisconsin because of their inability to get a tax credit here that Wisconsin offered them. So if I were going to recommend some very specific changes, number one is I would not limit it to accredited investors. Limit it to offerings that are exempt or that are subject to, or excuse me, not subject to, but that are registered under the SCORE offering. Now, exempt means they have to comply with the law in terms of making sure that they fit into one of those one of those exceptions from registration, or that they've gone through the, it's the lawyer in me, I love that word, or that they've gone through the process and had the state see and review, Department of Commerce see and review their offering statement. Second, and this actually would be a limitation, several of the securities exemptions include limitations on the ability of bad boys to use the exemption. So if you're somebody who's had certain types of problems with the U.S. attorney, with the state's attorney, with the SEC, with the stock exchanges, NASDAQ, etc., you cannot use that exemption. It seems to me that it would be a very easy limitation, a way to protect the people investing in these deals, to have a limitation like that here. Now, it is subject to waiver, and so somebody who had something they did long ago in their past and they've turned into an upright citizen and so forth, or there's one person affiliated but there are other people there to control, it can be waived. But let's consider having that as a limitation on use. Third, the bill as it reads right now says that if the issuer fails to file its report in the subsequent years, the credit is lost and is subject to recovery. I'm an investor. I'm not the person running the company. I'm not even a family member of the person running the company, so I don't have the traditional, well, guess what I can tell your wife, leverage. Those people are not prohibited, are not permitted to get this credit. So now I invest in a company, and 2 years later, management walks away and the company fails to, because the company is doing poorly or other reasons, and the company fails to make that filing. I've lost my credit. It's nothing that I've done on my part. It's just it's a limitation that's there. I'm not saying that there should not be a way to control it, but that's a harsh method to impose on me to have that limitation. Fifth and finally is one of the requirements of having to do with the accredited investor is that the person stay an accredited investor through the time that they would be eligible to receive the credit. Accredited investor is a concept relevant to the point of investment. If I'm an accredited investor because I've got a net worth of $1 million when I make this investment, but the next year the market does another turnaround on us and my value drops off of all my other investments, and I've made this investment, does that mean I should lose the credit? And the way the rule reads now, it would mean that I would lose that. And that's not the way that it should be. So I'm sure there's more that I intended to say, but I'll stop at that, and I'm happy to answer any questions. And thank you very much for listening.
Thank you very much, Mr. Schley. Did I say
Schley?
Schley, I'm sorry. questions for Mr. Schley. Representative Downey.
If I may.
Oh.
Representative Downey is yielding. Not you. Yes. To do that.
So polite this
pointing
evening.
In my
Representative Dabney.
I think it was your fourth point, sir, on failure to file
the appropriate forms on the part of the business triggering a loss of the credit for the investor. It's possible, and I double-checked with staff because they're smarter than members, it's possible you were looking at a previous version of the bill. Currently, a failure to file on the part of the business, and staff will correct me if I get it wrong, yields a $500 fine to the business, not a loss of credit to the investor. And the loss of credit, the triggers for loss of credit, such as not making the holding period or not the wage or employee numbers, go against the business, not against the investor.
I'm
having just seen this draft tonight, I will not contest that that's what it says. I'll look at it again, and so be it if I've read it wrong.
Representative Dabney, I'm looking at page 8, line 12 and 13 about the $500 fine. So this is for failing to file an annual report?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. Page 8, lines 12 and 13 deal with of the H2695DE1A amendments, sir. Just to clarify, for you and for the committee.
Thank you.
Very good. Representative Downey.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Sly, thanks for coming forward. I think you've raised some interesting points that we might want to consider here as we would finalize language here. One overriding question, as I heard your testimony, was that it sounded like you really wanted to open this up to the garage business, the true innovator, bootstrapping something at the very beginning. And I think others might disagree with me on this, but I know one of my reasons for being comfortable with this is that we have accredited investors and typically or oftentimes some kind of an angel fund, i.e. people very knowledgeable in these kind of startup ventures, serving as a little bit of a vetting or a filtering on the opportunities that we would offer credits to. And I'm not personally real comfortable with offering refundable credits to anybody who shows up because we could be incentivizing lots of people to fail as compared to offering an incentive that actually only kicks in when they succeed. So maybe just an observation from your experience on opening it up to these exempt investors as compared to accredited. Are we opening up the filter too wide to businesses that to anybody that wants to show up and take a credit as compared to really pretty vetted and qualified ideas and business opportunities?
In terms of opening up to anybody, the company would still need to go and make its application and be certified that it meets the requirements. But when you say the you had a phrase I wish I could remember right now about opening up to anybody, the problem that I have is the situation of the twin brothers separated at birth. One grows up in Wayzata, one grows up in, I hate to pick a city, but pick your small town. They have the same invention. They get to the point where they've done what they can in their garage. Now they need to go out and spend $150,000 to make a prototype. They talk to their lawyer, me, and I say, here's what you can do. You can go talk to your accredited investors. And so the fellow in Wayzata pulls out his Rolodex and says, okay, here are the 14 people I'm going to call. And the fellow in the small city first says, now what's an accredited investor? And you explain it to him. He says, well, I know three. I know my banker, my accountant, and you. You interested in investing? And it's a problem that's very real. We used to have a very special, as I said before, a very special capital market for early stage companies. And get me some time with more time, and I can tell you story after story after story of early companies. A fair number of them fail. Understand that the companies fail. But they would never have been able to get done in today's market. I understand that there's risk, but I think that the fact that the certification of the issuer is already required is what fixes it. You've got the disqualification of the investor based upon affiliation. You've got the requirement that the credit is not usable for the 3 years. If my mother calls me up and says, I want to invest in the deal that I talked about with the particle board, and in order to invest, I have to put in $25,000, my response is, Mom, I'm starting the commitment proceedings. But if she calls up and says, gee, I've got these friends who are talking about this, it sounds great to me, I want to put in $2,000, okay, don't go to Little Six next weekend. Now, you've got a requirement in here of next three weekends. You've got a requirement. Although she usually wins.
Mom's kind of a high roller.
You've got a requirement in here of a minimum investment, and if I recall, it was $10,000. Is that right? Which I can't complain. Obviously, I could wish that was smaller in some ways, but that's a reasonable number. I'm not going to challenge that. So when I say 2,000, you know, 10,000 versus 30,000, if the investor's willing to make that investment and the company fits within the criteria, why should they be denied the access to that same credit? And why should the company, the entrepreneur, who only happens to know people of low net income, also not have access to it? There's another thing I thought of that I didn't write down. One of the requirements in the bill is that once the certification is obtained, the funding is required to be obtained within 60 days. Companies at that early stage, that's generally not the way it works. You don't have the deal prearranged and then you come apply. You go out, you put together your documents, and you go apply for the credits. Then you go out and you raise your money on a best efforts basis. You have an escrow where every investor gives you their money. It goes into a bank account, and you can't take the money out of the bank until you reach the minimum amount that you say you need. That can take more time than that. So the 60-day time period, I can understand reasons, particularly of wanting to make it available to other people if you're not going to. But at least in the offering that is more broadly done, such as the SCORE offering, the 60 days, I think, needs to be longer.
Representative Wolf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Sly. I understand the accredited have to be a millionaire because you can absorb the risk without not being able to make your house payment for a long time. The bill provides for qualified funds. And would the qualified funds be a solution to the twin that was separated at birth that doesn't have any rich friends, having access to people who actually can absorb the risk, as opposed to that person going down to the local bar and talking a lot of people into putting a lot of money on the line that maybe they can't?
I don't know. I don't think so. The reason is I think that the fund is really designed to allow the investors to have a broader diversification. But those funds, I do not believe, will have the access to the same type of investors. Plus, more importantly, somebody is managing that fund. And the person who's managing that fund is more likely going to be somebody living in Wayzata than it is somebody living in Richfield.
Well, if I might just follow up, Mr. Chair.
Representative Loeffler.
I'd be more comfortable if we created within the structure of this bill a system by which a fund is incentive to reach out to those small investors and diversify their investments. Because quite honestly, I don't think most people who are just helping Joe Blow down the street with his great idea are really able to manage the risk. And for them to be able to get into a diversified offering would be a good thing for them as well.
I'm not going to challenge the goal of diversification. I will say that the special market that we had here before the 92 drop in the market was small companies raising money from a broad number of investors. And we've got story after story in the past of companies that have done that. If people make investments and the companies don't survive, if their business plan just doesn't work, there's a loss of money. And you want people to be able to understand that. You don't have to be accredited to understand that. Accreditation is a net worth. Your parents may have been born wealthy.
Before I call on Representative Poles, can I just get a show of hands? Anybody left who wants to give testimony? One, two. Okay. Representative Poles.
Mr. Chair, I just have a very quick question. Mr. Sly, you indicated that the 60 days from your perspective is too short of a
yes.
period of time, but you didn't give us your opinion as to what a more reasonable period of time, given the competing interests of trying
sure.
to get this done. I mean, is 90 days enough? Is 120 days enough? What is a reasonable period of time?
I'll speak to deals that I have done that have used the non-prearranged placements and that have used the SCORE offering. In the non-prearranged placements where it's essentially, well, okay, we've got the stuff done, let's go sell. 60 days, some get done. 120 days is the more typical time period. In those offerings, there's a requirement that the funds, when the investor writes the check, be put into escrow. So the investor writes the check. He's now committed to invest. But the company can't take the money until the minimum is met. If the minimum isn't met within some period of time, all the money goes back. That period of time typically is 120 days. It can be longer or shorter. Now, on the score offering, the registered offering, that's probably more like 180 days.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Sly.
Thank you.
We've got two more, Mr. Griffin and this gentleman here. And Representative Paymar.
Chair, I just wanted Rob McKenzie from the United Auto Workers to speak briefly about the Ford plant project, and we also have representatives from Deed and the City of St. Paul and Ramsey County if there are any questions.
Very good. Thank you. Just Mr. McKenzie, if you could identify yourself for the record again.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Rob McKenzie. I worked at the Ford assembly plant for 28 years. I currently work for the staff of the National United Auto Workers Union, and I wanted to speak very briefly about the legislation pertaining to the plant. You know, it's really a pretty remarkable fact that the Twin City Assembly Plant is still open. In April of 2006, Ford announced they were going to close the plant, and this was after a couple years of being on the edge. By the end of that year, they offered all the employees various buyouts. 1,600 of the 1,800 employees took buyouts in December. When they came back after Christmas, they went to one shift. They had 200 people who hadn't taken buyouts. They brought back a number of the temporary people who had taken buyouts as temporary workers at reduced wages and benefits, hired some more temporaries. All the skilled trades jobs were outsourced because they had taken buyouts, but they had skills that couldn't be replaced, so they outsourced the skilled trades. They're represented by the building trades now, and patched together a workforce they thought would limp along for a year. Now, I was their staff, their international staff rep. With that many different types of people and all the various benefits, I thought it was likely they would be killing each other before the year was out. Now, what happened was, on the road to oblivion, they became probably the best workforce in North America in an auto plant. And that's not just my own admittedly biased opinion, but they have won every award in automobile manufacturing, all the top awards. Now, they don't mean much to people who don't know automobile manufacturing, but J.D. Powers is recognized as the top quality award in automobile manufacturing. They've won the best quality compact truck 2 years in a row. They've won the only real efficiency comparison between plants is called the Harbor Award. So they have won for, they didn't win. They came in second or third, but they're working with one shift compared to plants that are on two shifts. Much more easy to be efficient on two shifts. So they are really a very efficient plant. And they won the top quality awards within the Ford system. The President's Award in North America goes to the top quality vehicle in the Ford system. That is the Ford Ranger 2 years in a row. And it's a lot of times when an automaker starts a plant, they'll throw a lot of money to get the quality good. Lots of engineering, lots of money. Nothing could be farther from the truth out there. The honest fact is when it rains, they don't repair the roof. They have to stop the production lines to keep them from getting wet. So what I'm trying to say by this is the workers have overcome tremendous obstacles to reach these goals. So, and but really why they're still open is they've become very, very profitable for Ford. That Ranger was designed to be phased out in 2001, and it was extended every 2 years. At this point, there is no six-cylinder engine that Ford makes that will even fit in this vehicle. So it will close in 2011. It's somewhat of a miracle that it's made it this far. So, you know, the world has changed since April 2006. Ford has had two profitable quarters. They've increased their market share significantly. They're still a little over capacity, but as a very realistic shot for this plant to get a new product, a new investment, and we appreciate everything you've done for us and the plant in the past. Thank you.
Thank you. And any questions for Mr. McKenzie? Great. I appreciate it very much. And Mr. Griffin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Phil Griffin. I'm representing Life Science Alley today. And I've been before the committee, I believe, on four occasions already this year. And I will try to be brief because of the late hour. I'd like to thank Representative Dabney for carrying the Angel Investor Tax Credit Bill. We are here tonight to support that. I'd also like to thank the chair
and her staff who have worked diligently and very hard to try and come up with some solutions to a number of questions that were raised. We believe that the provision as it stands before us today is very good. We have a couple of small minor items that we'd like to continue working with staff on, but I'm just here to give our support to this provision. If there are questions, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to answer them at this time, but I know the hour is late, and I'm anxious to try and see my son to find out what actually happened at school today.
I hear you. Questions for Mr. Griffin? Thanks very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any final public testimony? Madam Chair, your wish is that we just lay the bill over. We're not going to be voting on it this evening, so we'll just lay the bill over. And Representative Mullery, can we do 2511?
Representative, this affects your district.
Representative Mullery.
Mr. Chair, just go ahead. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Basically, Mr. Chair.
Excuse me, Representative, do you want to move 2511?
Mr. Chair and members, basically, almost all of this bill, except Section 1, you've already heard about in the
Excuse me, Representative Mullery. Folks in the committee room, if you can maybe take conversations out, we still have some business to conduct here tonight. Ms. McDonald? Go ahead, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Basically, almost all of the provisions of this bill, except Section 1, you've already heard about there in the Lincheski bill. Section 1 pretty much gives the rights to other cities in the states to do what can now be done in the, I'm not sure if it's roughly eight cities or something like that that have the special laws for housing replacement districts. And that allows an extra 10 percentage points outside the geographic area. And it can be used for low-income housing, and then there's a few new provisions, such as that it can be 150% of average market value. I believe that this one strengthens the vacant provision. I believe it's just vacant in the other laws, and this one is 3 months. And I believe the rest is foreclosure and substandard and vacant site, and this is up to 2015. The reason I believe is, and Jen O'Rourke is from the League of Cities, but there are other places other than the eight, I think it's somewhere around eight cities that have this, places other than the eight, I think it's somewhere around eight cities that have the special laws. And there's certain other suburbs, certain places that are old cities in around the state that could use this, and Jen O'Rourke will explain that further.
Thank you, Representative. Welcome, Ms. O'Rourke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jennifer O'Rourke. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. We're the statewide organization representing cities, and I'll be brief and respond to what Representative Mullery has presented with you with in 2511 here. This idea came from the Minnesota Foreclosure Partners Council, which has been a collaboration team of sorts the last 2 years, coming up with different ideas, things that are currently in statute, and then other ideas on how to deal with the foreclosure crisis. Paul Boland from the city of Fridley was here this afternoon, as was Jim Urkel with the Metropolitan Consortium of Community Developers. We're here this afternoon to also testify in support of House File 2511. But as Representative Mullery said earlier, this actually goes a little further beyond what Representative Lincheski included in her delete all that was presented with you tonight. You know, as far as the foreclosure issue goes, this really is a statewide issue. Not all cities will be taking advantage of this pooling option if it does go forward, but we believe this would afford a number of cities in the state the option of using the affordable housing pooling that's already in statute to take care of some of the other foreclosure issues that a lot of neighborhoods are dealing with.
Thank you, Mr. O'Rourke. And I'm guessing from your comment that those other two testifiers didn't hang with us here till the end.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
All right. And committee, it's I know, Madam Chair, we looked at this last year in our little subcommittee, but I know not everybody got as in-depth as we did. So, members, are there questions for Ms. O'Rourke, for Representative Mullery? Start with Representative Coles and then Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Mullery or Ms. O'Rourke, help me out here a little bit. I'm trying to, I mean, I hear the plea from my cities and cities across the state that they don't have any money. They don't have money to pay for cops, they don't have money to pay for firefighters, but we're going to redo housing. I mean, help me understand what impact, if any, there's going to be on property taxpayers if a city were to take advantage of this.
Ms. O'Rourke?
I'll take that. Representative Coles, or Mr. Chair and Representative Coles, like cities are able right now to use this extra 10% of extra increment for affordable housing, they would also be able to use that same increment, sort of like Joe Michaels explained earlier, they could use that for some of the foreclosure problems that they're having in neighborhoods where maybe it's not affordable housing per se, but I think the term is market rate housing that's described in the bill. You're correct. We've been talking about the effects of unallotments and LGA cuts over the past couple of years, and it's not, I think I can vouch for a lot of cities who would be ready to testify. They're not looking to take over neighborhoods or any extra real housing issues per se, but deal with some pretty targeted situations. And if I could respond to an earlier comment, Representative Mullery is correct. There have been a number of cities, maybe in that 6 to 8 range, who have been mentioned in statute over the year, which has led to a little bit of confusion. Some cities have been given this authority and didn't actually use it. I think there's some suburbs that fell into that category, so it's a little confusing as to who's used this in the past.
Thank you, Ms. O'Rourke. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. O'Rourke. I don't have any problem with dealing with vacant, substandard, foreclosed properties or expanding the communities that could potentially be eligible. But I'm not sure about the being able to develop housing that does not exceed 150% of the average market value in that city. There can be really wide disparities in cities. And I wouldn't have any problem with going up to that level in an area where it was really a depressed economy and you need to bring some people with money to support that particular part of that community. But I could also see a community where part of a city where, you know, the average, let's say the average sale price is $300,000 and all of a sudden we're using this to build $450,000 homes. I don't think that's really what this is really intended to. And so I'd really like, if we're going to move forward with this, to really focus it so that in terms of single family at a higher than average value, it's really in depressed areas that need some significant economic reinvestment as opposed to going to the nicest part of that particular city and letting a developer do a dream project that probably doesn't need a subsidy.
Mr. Representative Mueller. Representative Loeffler. That's almost word for word what you said, except you were sitting over there last year. And I take it into account. I think that I'm not sure exactly how to phrase it because there, as you said, there's certain areas that really need to have market value put in because there's so many studies that show that if you continue to put poverty on poverty, you have problems. And I'm not sure if the League of Cities has looked at that issue since last year or not, since I know that you raised that exact thing. Do you know?
Ms. O'Rourke?
Mr. Chair and Representative Loeffler, I'd be glad to check with some of the other advocates and see if there's better language that could come forward before tomorrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'd be glad to give you some ideas, too, but I think there are ways to narrow it without it having sort of violating the expectation.
Members, other questions for either of the testifiers? All right. Thank you. Members, I don't think we have any other items on our agenda tonight. Madam Chair, do you have any comments before we close?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do. That is, if you haven't noticed, you tax committee was posted for tomorrow night, and we're going to try to take up the tax committee target of cuts tomorrow night and vote them out tomorrow night. And the target, you know, this committee, if you don't know, is 105 in 10 and 210 in 11. And I shared that with Representative Broad within hours of learning it myself. And so if folks have alternative proposals to what the majority might put out there, we are attempting to pass it out of committee tomorrow night. And so we're going to cancel taxes tomorrow morning. So we have tax committee tomorrow night. I know sometimes people haven't checked their schedules, but you should all have that on your schedule by now. And just wanted folks to know that we're hoping to vote tomorrow night on that.
And we're, Madam Chair, we're starting again at 6:30, correct?
6:30, right. Thanks.
Representative Broad.
Mr. Chairman, Madam Chairman, when are we going to see the language on the bill? Do you have that?
Well, we actually have two versions of language. We just haven't decided which one we support yet.
Did we have both?
I'll be just totally honest. I'm going over tomorrow morning to meet with Senator Bach and to try to see if the House and Senate can get a little closer before they pass their separate, 105 cuts. So hopefully we can come to some agreement, and we may not. But as soon as possible, I guess we'll just post it online. Maybe it's the quickest way and get it to Mr. Stone, too, directly. So.
Representative Broad.
Thank you. And Madam Chairman, I guess I'm a little concerned about the lack of having access for the public to see what's going on. And I know that you're trying to run within the framework of what the House is trying to do. But, I mean, is there any reason why we couldn't get the bill out tomorrow and give people an opportunity to see it, to walk through it, and then look at passing it out on Wednesday? Or is that caused some pretty significant time crunch? It's my understanding that Thursday's kind of the day where it's got to be gone. Would Wednesday work?
Chair Lachowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Brown. I think the time crunch problem is because the cuts have to go through Ways and Means. The idea was we would go to the floor on Wednesday so we could move. Sorry, Monday? Yeah. We'd go to the floor on Wednesday so we could move the tax cuts through the floor, through finance, to Ways and Means, so that on Wednesday afternoon, Ways and Means would be hearing it. So that's the sort of time tag we're on. I mean, there is a possibility you could do it early Wednesday morning because we have the three-hour rule before we pass it through on the floor session on Thursday. But we are kind of under a time crunch. I think the thing that, is noteworthy on cuts, I mean, cuts are pretty simple. There's not a lot of language going on when you're just taking money away. So I think the language that I've looked at for kind of both versions are about 3 to 4 pages in both versions. And so I don't think there's a lot of complicated language. It's just numbers with minuses next to them. So, they have to total minus 105. So, everybody can take a crack at it if they want to try to do it. And folks know that this committee certainly has all kinds of tax expenditures, but on the aids and credit side, there's very few accounts.
And Madam Chair and Mr. Chairman, I just want to make sure that from a definitional standpoint, so the public is not confused also, we're not talking about tax cuts, meaning the lessening of their tax burden. We're talking about spending reductions, and I just want to make sure that when we're talking about the tax cut bill, people shouldn't get all excited about the fact that they'll have the opportunity, Representative Riccovina, to keep more of their own money.
Mr. Chair, if I might, and I think that is important, and we are being televised, so that helps. I mean, these are spending cuts. This is budget cuts, and a lot of folks, have wanted to begin the cutting, and forget that we have been cutting hundreds of millions of dollars for years, but we're going to try to cut even more tomorrow. So these are reducing government tomorrow, and so folks who want to have alternatives on how to cut 105 out of the tax aids and credits, we welcome all the proposals possible so we can debate them.
Representative Broad.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Madam Chairman. I appreciate the opportunity to clarify that. Also, I think tomorrow maybe we could have somebody, or maybe we'll provide it, kind of the differences between where the governor's at in terms of the reductions, the spending reductions, and where our target is. Now, I think it's important to keep in mind that our target, or the target that your committee has, is there's two big spending items that are left out there that aren't accomplished within either our tax target or any target that's out there, and that's the Health and Human Service area and the K-12 area. And so the likelihood that this committee will be back at some point making some additional reductions is probably quite great in some capacity, and I think that's just something that we'll want to have a little conversation about as well. And then further, if the unallotment lawsuit turns a certain direction, we'll be back again. So this might be just shot number one.
Chair Lencheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just point out, I know folks want to, kind of do everything holistically, but the tax committee can only cut in the tax area. So we can't cut the health budget in the tax bill, and we can't cut the K. We could cut the K-12 budget actually through all the levies, but if we wanted to. But really, we're limited. We don't have the environment committee target. We don't have the local government target. We have the tax committee target. So. Certainly we always say everything's germane in this committee, and this is the one committee that everything's germane in and that drives everyone crazy. But, we are focused on areas in the cutting in taxes, not in the other areas. So,
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't mean to belabor this, but so I should not go home and tell folks that we are actually cutting taxes. We will be extracting more revenue as compared to less.
No.
Is that a
no? Shrinking government. Mr. Chair, and if I can clarify, this is for folks who want government to get smaller. Tomorrow's your chance. You have to cut, not, you're cutting $105 million of government spending. Yeah. If you want to cut $300, $400, $500 million, I have a bill that I put in a bill that cuts $1.2 billion. So folks who want to cut more, jump on in. But this committee's target is assigned to cut 105. So no, it's not raising revenue. It's cutting $105 million permanently out of the Minnesota state budget and 210 ongoing. So it is budget cuts. It's not raising any revenue. There's no new tax increases in it. It's shrinking government.
Particularly local government. So, any other comments, committee members? If not, we'll see lots of each other tomorrow. We're adjourned.
Thank you.